Is the regular meeting of the Morro Bay City Council. It is Tuesday, June 11th, 2019, 5:30 p.m. We do have a quorum of council members. We are located at 209 Surf Street at the Veterans Hall, Morro Bay, California. And with that, I will call the meeting to order and ask for a moment of silence, please. Thank you. And Mr. Casares, would you lead us in the pledge, sir, please?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Ready, salute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay. Thank you. And with that, Mr. City Attorney, do we have any closed session items to report on?
Yes, Mr. Mayor. On May 29th, 2019, City Council met in closed session, and there were two reportable actions that came out of that closed session. One of them was City Council directed City Attorney's Office to commence necessary legal action to abate the public nuisance at 320 Orchis Street, Morro Bay, California. And also to be noted that item CS1 that was considered on May 29th, due exclusively to unanticipated time constraints, that item was not completed as expected. And to ensure participation by the entire City Council, it was continued to the next closed session scheduled on June 11th, 2019. As for the closed session held today on June 11th, 2019, there's no reportable action.
Thank you. Appreciate that. And with that, I will turn to council members for council member reports. Who'd like to start us off? Council member Heller, any reports? Council member McPherson? None. Council member Addis?
Yes, we did receive some letters from the community asking Morro Bay to write a letter opposing the possible fracking in Slo County, and so I wanted to let the public know that I did write a letter personally using my council member title, in title only, and that I will be bringing this up for discussion of possible future agenda items for the city to take a stance on land fracking. Because what I discovered in the process is that we don't have a resolution around on land fracking, so it may be something that we want to discuss. So I'll bring that up later. And then I will have office hours in the form of a hike on Eagle Rock on June 18th between 3 and 4:30, and then again July 25th with Project Surf in the afternoon.
Great. Thank you. Council Member Davis.
Yes. Thank you. Am I on?
You're always on. You mean your mic?
I want to recognize one of our special Morro Bay citizens tonight, Bob Keller. Bob is a spark plug for Project Surf Camp. He energizes the annual fundraising campaign. We can see that up on the screen. They're going to have a barbecue later this month. And he also works during the camp with the young people. Bob is also the unelected mayor of the Harbor District. He walks his neighborhood frequently and gathers questions, and he brings them to the council and asks those questions and provides us feedback. He also is my most frequent visitor at office hours, and I always appreciate the questions he brings and the opportunity I have to speak back to the community through him. My wife calls Bob Morro Bay's Goodwill Ambassador. Second item, in conjunction with the Amgen Tour of California, our Tourism Bureau sponsored a photo contest among the Morro Bay High School students based on bike themes or outdoor activities, and I want to announce the names of our three winners. Emily Duclos won first place. Her prize was a 32-gigabyte iPad. Reese Tartaglia won second place and a set of AirPods. I don't know what those are. And Maya Cabrinha won third place and a $100 Apple gift card. So congratulations to them. And I got to go to the high school and make the presentations. I am just so impressed always when I see our high school students. They are poised and confident and capable, and just a joy to be around. At the SLOCOG board last week, the board approved a funding for a new replacement trolley for Morro Bay, $174,000. And the board also approved $194,000 for the design of a new transit hub building at City Park. And that's going to replace the current building. The new building will still be on Harbor Street. It'll be moved a little farther up the street. And the construction will take place next year with additional funding from SLOCOG. And then my office hours, I'm going to do office hours this coming Saturday at Sun and Buns from 9 o'clock until 10 o'clock, and I hope to see Bob Keller there.
Thank you. I also wrote a letter opposing fracking, as did Councilmember Addis, as a council member, not representing the full council, but on my own, since we have not taken a position yet. Just wanted to make note of that. Thank you. Then also this morning I had the great opportunity of attending and welcoming, as your mayor, the first annual Project Surf Camp Summer Learning Institute. 250 teachers from across the state gathered here in Morro Bay and will be here for 3 days learning about making a difference for all students, all student groups, all types of students, looking at behavioral issues, increasing cognitive attention in classrooms, a whole number of wonderful teaching opportunities or learning opportunities for teachers, I should say. Had good representation from our San Luis Coastal Unified School District, and it's great to see some of the offshoot of Project Surf Camp and the great job that they do every year here with kids at the beach, but also now a learning institute that just seemingly will continue to grow in the future. So kudos to them and John Taylor and his group for the great work that they're doing with young people, not only in this community, but now across the state as well. Sure, absolutely.
One more announcement I wanted to make is on Thursday, June 20th at 5:30 p.m. at Morro Bay High School in J2, which is the new STEAM building. The Morro Bay Chamber is putting on Women Making Waves, and I get to do part of the welcome, but it's going to feature Ola Weinstein from Castle Wind, Dr. Joyce Carter, who is the first African-American chief medical examiner appointed in the history of our nation, and she is the coroner here in Sauk County. She'll be presenting Judy Mahan, who is the director of Cal Poly's small business incubator, and an SBDC director will be there. And then Laura Godfrey-Zager, who is a partner at Perkins Coal, will be speaking, and Kathleen Markov, president of Markov Executive Training. And so the community is welcome. Again, it's on June 20th at 5:30 at Morro Bay High School's new STEAM wing in J2.
Great event. I signed up. Be there. Yeah. So thank you for that. With that, I will turn it over to our city manager for his report. Mr. Collins.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, Council. City Council, Scott Collins, City Manager, and just a couple of things I wanted to make the community aware of. One, in the most recent water and sewer bill, we put an insert in there about the upcoming rate increases. That includes the 2015, the last of those rate increases, plus the wharf surcharge. So that's in the June bill. We'll have more information in the July bill, anticipating the actual rate increase going into effect for both of those August 1st. That payment will be due August 30th, so we're trying to do our best to get the information out so it doesn't come as a shock to people. Also, want to apprise the community and City Council that we've hosted two community input sessions on the question of including vacation rentals and RV park owners into the T-bid process. Right now, they don't pay into the T-bid, but they definitely benefit from the marketing that goes on from the entire Morro Bay community. So there was a lot of good dialogue, a lot of good questions and answers, and that information will be brought back to the TBID board next week, next Thursday morning. And any recommendations that comes out of that would come back to City Council. And we'll have a little bit more discussion later this evening on the item around the TBID assessment.
Thank you. Appreciate that. With that, we have our business spot this evening, none other than Ms. Susan Stewart. Susan, welcome. Great to see you up here. Glad you're here to tell us a little bit about Beads by the Bay.
Thank you. Good evening, Mayor, Council, staff, and citizens of Morro Bay. Thanks for having me here. I guess I don't have to say my name because the mayor did, Susan Stewart. I own a little shop called Beads by the Bay at 333 Morro Bay Boulevard between the Thai Elephant Restaurant and Queen's Closet. I've had the business for almost 14 years now. It's a bead store which supplies all kinds of beads, obviously, charms and pendants and all the parts you need to make anything that you can make using beads, necklaces, bracelets, earrings, window or car charms, mosaics, knitted or crocheted items, collages, and even fishing lures. We get a lot of that in there. We also do repairs, commissioned items, and rescue relationships by providing the perfect gift at the last minute. Because beads have been around for at least 40,000 years and have been created all over the world from shell, bone, horn, stone, glass, pearls, coins, basically anything you can make a hole in, the shop has an international flavor with new and old beads and charms from across the globe and close to home, too. It's a relatively inexpensive hobby, a fairly safe and healthy addiction, as it generally causes no cirrhosis, bankruptcy, broken bones, or broken marriages. We do provide a lot of free counseling at the shop, however. What makes the store especially unique is the beautiful garden in the back. We sell succulents, air plants, scented geraniums, seasonal herbs, pottery, garden art, and miniature garden supplies. There is a covered space out there for working on projects, taking classes, and a potting table for potting up a plant or creating a little fairy garden to take home. It's a relaxing zen place to be. There's a pond with goldfish masquerading as koi, and free entertainment watching hummingbirds or the ongoing battles between the seagull that's nesting on the Thai restaurant roof and a pesky crow. The garden can be available for small parties as well. The property itself has belonged to the Schneider family for several generations, and through the years I've heard stories about previous businesses. Some of you may remember Madam and the Cowboy. There was apparently a seamstress for a bit who had a tenant living in the tiny room that is now an office. She had to climb out the window during business hours. There was a lawyer, probably not a good one given where he was. But my favorite was that it was apparently the only barber shop in town for a while. The barber was a man named Bill Tandy who had three fingers on one hand and used to run cattle in the Mojave in the 30s before he retired to be a barber. He was the first stop for the fishermen coming in off their boats, and he would send them to the back to hose off with cold water before cutting their hair so they could go home a little more cleaned up. The shop is open every day between 10 and 5, Monday through Saturday, and 11 to 5 on Sunday. We have a website. We don't sell stuff off the website, but it is for information. Tells about the classes, www.morrobaybeads.com. Phone number is 805-772-3338, and we do have a Facebook page. So I hope you come and visit us in the heart of Old Town Morro Bay. Thank you.
Great, Susan. Thank you so much. Great history lesson, too. Appreciate that. A barber and beads. So that's pretty cool. Yeah. Thank you for that. With that, I will open up public comment. This is for members of the public that want to speak on items on the agenda and can't stay for the meeting, and or who would like to speak on anything that's not on the agenda. There are speaker slips in the back, no requirement to fill them out. However, I do have a number of speaker slips that folks did fill out. I'll take those first and then open it up to others that may want to speak. So first up is Mr. Bob Keller. Bob, welcome.
Mayor, councilmen, staff, and Morro Bay citizens. My name is Bob Keller, Morro Bay. I want to thank Red Davis for the kind words and comments. He is more than generous. Anyway, Tonight I will make a public comment I believe we can all agree on. Surfs up. Anyway, I am a volunteer for Project Surf Camp. Been a volunteer for many years. I love it. It makes my day. And I believe it'll make your day if anybody else gets involved. So I have a flyer up on the screen there. And if you can't read it, I'll explain it to you. Every year, at the end of June, the last Friday in June, June 28th, we put on a big barbecue. And it's all donated. It doesn't cost us a dime. Plus, we have all volunteers that work on it. And we also sell raffle tickets for the ones that want to come. That's the only expense that you guys have, but you don't have to buy raffle tickets, but we have great prizes. Prizes all the way from TVs, paddleboard, sometimes bikes. And then we have numerous other great prizes that exceeds the value of your raffle ticket. So this barbecue is across from City Hall, the library, San Luis Sports Therapy. Mike Williams does this every year. He donates all this time. Anyway, the time is going to be, some people show up at 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., but the barbecue starts at 12 noon. And it's on 890 Chasta Avenue, Morro Bay. Like I say, we have raffle drawings. A lot of our businessmen give us great prizes. So I think you'll enjoy it. Next, we also have a blood drive that goes along with the barbecue. And we have a flyer on that, too. That's a San Luis Sports Therapy, same location. It's in the parking lot behind the sports therapy where we do our sometimes barbecue and people can sit in the back. It's a nice, beautiful day, indoors and outdoors. And also the blood drive, for the donors, they have prizes including, it's kind of like a lottery, but Disneyland tickets, a 55-inch TV, video games, consoles, smartwatches, airline gift tickets, Amazon gift cards, tablets, and this is called the Valiant Squag. But anyway, they draw for your name if you give blood. I don't know what else to say, but I'll tell you this. We do start our camp right after the 4th of July, which is July the 5th, 9 a.m., Coleman Park. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Next up for public comment is Barry Brannon. Barry, welcome.
Thank you, Mayor. Barry Brannon, Morro Bay Council. I'm sorry I won't be able to stay for the C1 agenda item tonight. It's a very important item. I went to the Wharf Cap meeting and heard the presentation. I've read all of the attachments. They didn't even print them out tonight. I think it's 300-500 pages. I don't know, but it's pretty complicated. What I'd like to talk about tonight is the path, the transmission, the pipelines. I walked the pipeline from Main Street back to Lila Kaiser Park and looked at the plans as I did it. And I want to commend the engineers. They have a project that the existing sewer plant is where the collection's coming in. And they're going to have a new location, and they have to pipe it out there. But I would say that when you're running a pipeline over a wetlands through PG&E property, which is a challenge, I understand, they're going to build a bridge across Morro Creek so they can put the pipes on the bridge right next to the current pipe bridge. You probably couldn't have made it a more difficult place. I've been in construction. I know what we're talking about. And I can't imagine the challenges that we've got. I know we're in a big hurry to get the money, but we have caused the engineering group to come up with a design to solve a problem, and I don't believe that's the best solution. You had a peer group come in and talk about the sewer plant, and you decided what to do, and they said, well, keep it close. Well, you decided not to keep it close. We're going to put it in a better alternative location. But I really believe that you should have a group look at this pipeline, because when they're going to try to go down through the bike path along the highway and the disturbance and the possible challenges are so enormous, and the disruption to the city, not alone going up Quintana. I read the list of all the people that would be affected by it. I know there's some other routes, but I really think that you need to take a breath and look at this project, this part of the project. It's over 50% of the total project is the pipeline. The plant's about $60 million. We have $120 million. So this is a huge part of the project. And I'm not seeing an environmental impact report. I guess there's going to be an addendum talking about that. But the impacts are just enormous. And it just took my breath away to walk down there and see what we have to do, the space between the PG&E plant, the Caltrans right away. It's a challenge. And I think that this project is... it's one of these things, once you start digging it up, you can't go back, and this is the time to look at it. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Barry. Appreciate that. And next up for public comment is Catherine Gillen. Catherine, welcome.
Thank you, Mayor Hedding, and esteemed members of the City Council, city staff, and our Morro Bay citizens. My name is Catherine Gillen, and I am the Member Relations Manager for the Morro Bay Chamber of Commerce, and I'm here to let you know of our upcoming events through the Chamber. June is ramping up to be a warm summertime agenda of events. First off, we have tomorrow's June Mixer, and I think I can put this on the overhead viewer. Thank you. And our June Mixer is an event for Morro Bay Chamber of Commerce members and for future members to come and see what the Chamber is all about and network with us. This will be at Marina Square tomorrow between the hours of 5:30 and 7:30, and it's showcasing the businesses of Tango, Seven Sisters Gallery, Intent, Windows on the Water, and Rancho Olivos. So come and enjoy the sunset with us. Don already told us about Women Making Waves, and that's happening in Morro Bay at the Morro Bay High School campus in the J-Wing building. And if you haven't been out to see it, it's a beautiful arts and sciences building at the high school. It's going to be from 5:30 to 8 p.m. There is a ticket cost, and it's one Alexander Hamilton, and that's a $10 bill to you. And from 5:30 to 6:30, there's networking. From 6:30 on, the panel discussions will start. Call the chamber office to get your ticket, or I've got some flyers with me today. Today and every day, the Morro Bay Chamber of Commerce fulfills its mission by connecting business peers to one another, to local leaders, and to community champions. Thank you again, and good night.
Thank you, Catherine. Appreciate the information. Next up for public comment is Linda Winters. Welcome, Linda. Mobile Home Park, Linda, I should say. You asked me to call you that, I know, last time. I remembered.
I appreciate that. Now that I have instant recognition, I feel my goal has been accomplished. Good evening. My name is Linda Winters, as you heard before. A 25-year resident living in the same mobile home park all these years. Mobile home living is my topic tonight and always. When we last met, May 28th, the City Council meeting, I spoke about meeting two goals, building a communications network throughout our 15 mobile home parks and keeping affordable housing. Several concerned members of city staff and council reached out to myself and our group to begin building this network as soon as possible. That was very heartening to realize that the city really wants to help all their citizens. We, several members of a statewide nonprofit ombudsman group that helped to interpret the MRL, which is the mobile home residency laws, Gizmo, the Golden State Manufactured Homeowners League, attended an all-day conference. The Gizmo reps and attorney sponsored in Templeton this Saturday, June 8th. It was held to inform mobile home Atascadero Mobile Home Park residents on how to adopt an RSO, which is a rental stabilization ordinance similar to the one that Morro Bay has in place. 7 Atascadero mobile home parks were at that conference. One of their city council members spoke to the group and addressing the city's position. 4 of our Gizmo members that attended gathered information from the Atascadero mobile home residents to build an even larger network of information to reach our goal of giving as many mobile home residents info about their rights according to the MRL. Our city council members and staff were invited to attend this, but it was on very short notice. Several have said that they would be happy to possibly meet with the Atascadero Council to ponder this extremely important ordinance. Our RSO is the only protection that we mobile home residents have to assure that we can afford to live in beautiful Morro Bay. I bet everyone in Morro Bay knows someone that is living in a mobile home park right now. Would those people inform mobile home residents that they have representation? Help us to build unity. Will the people that live in mobile home parks right now please raise their hands? Okay, we have 997 more mobile home residents that we need to reach. And thank you for your time. I appreciate everything that you guys are doing.
Thank you, Linda. Appreciate that. Public comment is still open. That's the last speaker slip that I have. Any members of the public wishing to come forward on any items on the agenda that can't stay for or items not on the agenda? Seeing that, welcome, Ken.
Good evening, council and staff. My name is Ken McMillan. I'm a business owner and property owner and a director on the chamber, but I'm not speaking as a director tonight. I just want to go through this little calendar. I opened my first restaurant, Los Osos, in 97. I opened my second restaurant, Morro Bay, in 2008. During that time, there was no interaction with anybody in Morro Bay as far as that second location to open it up and, you know, where and whatever they could do to help. We closed the second location in Morro Bay in 2011 and moved to a bigger building that had been vacant derelict for 12 to 13 years. It was formerly owned by the city of Morro Bay and sold to a Fresno individual. He and I worked out a deal to move into the new building and hopefully resurrect that area next to Dawn's on the Hill. We became successful. The area became a destination again. But no entity in Morro Bay worked with us on enlarging our business or moving or helping occupy the formerly vacant building. It was an eyesore. Now, the city managed to gain ownership of the property again in 2017 and gave us basically 2 years to move because they wanted to put in new development. Now, I would venture to say that was not relocation assistance. There was nothing that was happening in that case either. My family made the tough decision to stay in Morro Bay. We got in a car, scouted the city until we found a property we liked, and we bought it and we developed it. Again, there was no participation from the city in any of this. Scott Graham, during this whole effort, was our only lifeline to the city, and thank you, because you were very helpful, you and your staff. And so we're rebuilding our business again right now. So the question I ask you is this an example of economic development? Put this in a business school, and this would be a case of what is not economic development. This was not what the way you handle it. Now, I know the city was going through turmoil and everything at that stage, but this doesn't work. We need to be all in. Everybody needs to be in this. And the chamber's role will be a big piece of this. I will tell you the other day in talking to a developer, local, says he doesn't feel loved. Not at all. And I understand why. Nobody has the time to really make these things happen. So all I'm saying is at this stage, I believe between the city, economic development in the city, and the chamber, we make this thing together, I believe this will work, because I believe, you know, and I'm a living example. I saw what was going to happen, and I decided to stay in town, and now I wanted to be part of it, and I'm being part of it. And it's only going to work if we get all in, all on board for this thing. Otherwise, it won't work, and the revenue base will go away. So thank you.
Thank you, Ken. Appreciate that. Public comment is still open for items either on the agenda that you wish to speak to or not on the agenda. Welcome, Dan.
My name is Dan Sedley, Morro Bay City resident. Along the lines of promoting public comment, I want to speak yet again about the chairs that we're forced to sit in and to attend these meetings many times for hours at a time. The subject has been talked about a lot, but hasn't changed. And I would like to see some progress on this issue and not just talked about. When is an answer going to come? Talk to the community about when this is coming, when this is happening, and let's do it. Let's just do it so the community's not sitting in these hard chairs. If you haven't had an opportunity, sit through the city council meeting in these chairs for 3 hours or 4 hours or whatever the meeting is. It's not inviting. So let's have a time frame. Let's have a plan. Let's do this instead of just talking about it, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. Public comment still open. And Richard, welcome.
Richard Sadowski, citizen Morro Bay. I can't stay, but I'd like to comment on the report regarding the Morro Basin aquifer and the injection. Several years ago, I was involved in an appeal to the California Coastal Commission regarding the closure of the MTBE monitoring wells. And that report showed the basically the Morro Basin aquifers downstream of the Narrows and how a plume, when the pumps and the city wells are being drawn, how this plume, they were studying the plume and studying that aquifer pretty extensively. It's my understanding that this new GSI report stating that we can inject into the Morro Basin aquifer and then be able to draw this and not have to go through any kind of treatment process, and I believe that that's falsification. Shortly after we appealed, the city had put in infrastructure because there was sucralose and exfiltrating sewage into the drinking water aquifer. So by diluting it, you're not solving the problem. And I believe that the other thing issue is the Ocean Protection Council scientific advisory team, the Ocean Science Trust, they are about to embark on a study of how sea level rise and coastal aquifers and saltwater intrusion. That study hasn't even been started yet. That is still a new, an emerging issue. And for us to play and assume that we could be injecting and manipulating an aquifer and doing essentially a scientific experiment, basically research and development on our drinking water aquifer is, you know, kind of pretentious and really ill-advised. Anyway, I would appreciate if the council kind of backed off on spending any money on this experiment. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. Public comment is still open. Any members of the public wishing to speak? Items on the agenda or not on the agenda? Seeing none, I will close public comment, bring it back to us. Scott, we did report, Dan, last week, last council meeting, I should say, on the vets' chairs, but maybe you could give a quick update on the replacement process?
Sure. A great point brought up by Dan. So we reviewed several different options for chairs. We want to make sure we able to find something that's going to support people being able to sit comfortably for several hours at a time and also be stackable, because we have to be able to store the chairs and also be ergonomic for our staff that set them out for every meeting. So we did find a firm and actually had one delivered. We tested it out, had council members sit in it. Other folks had visited my office to sit in and make sure, you know, it wasn't just my voice that was involved in this. And we found a chair that we like. We got a purchase order set. I believe the purchase has been made, and Rob can probably give an update about when we expect those to arrive.
The vendor is National Business Furniture. They expect 2 to 4 week delivery time after the PO was issued, and I believe we issued that PO last week. So maybe not next council meeting, but should be the council meeting after that. We should have new chairs in here. And it's 50 chairs, so if we get a large crowd, we'll still have to back that up with our existing chair supply.
Very well. I think our community will appreciate that in the end. Pun intended. Pun intended. That's serious. I've sat there for some of the subcommittee meetings and absolutely echo what Dan said. So thank you. That's coming, Dan. Should be in the next couple of meetings. Thanks for bringing that up. With regard to Mr. Sadowski's and also Mr. Brannon's comments, we'll cover those under item C1, and I'll ask Mr. Casares to address that at that time. So with that, I will open up any public comment for consent agenda. These are for items A1 through A7. Any members of the public wishing to come forward on any of the consent agenda items, please do so now. Surveying the room, seeing none, I will close public comment on the consent agenda, bring it back to council, either seek a motion for approval and or any items you wish to pull. We can take those off the table and let's consider those separately. Any items to pull? None?
I move we approve items A1 through A7 on the consent agenda.
Your mic's not working tonight.
Second.
Motion by Council Member McPherson, second by Council Member Davis to approve consent agenda. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor, we're going to do roll call, sorry. Wrong meeting.
Council Member McPherson.
Yes.
Council Member Davis.
Yes.
Council Member Addis.
Yes.
Council Member Heller.
Yes.
And Mayor Hedding.
Yes.
Motion carries 5-0.
Great. Thank you for that. And that brings us to item number B-1. This is adoption of resolution number 45-19, continuing the program and levying the assessments for 2019-2020 fiscal year for the Morro Bay Tourism Business Improvement District, or TBID. With that, I will turn it over to our esteemed city manager for a presentation. This is a public hearing item, which I'll open up after the staff presentation and council questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor, Councilmember Scott Collins, city manager. I didn't prepare a PowerPoint. We had brought this forward last meeting as part of the renewal process. It had also gone to TBID prior to that for their review and recommendation. Ultimately, what we're recommending is adoption resolution number 45-19, continuing the program and levying the assessments for the fiscal year 2019-20 for Morro Bay Tourism Business Improvement District. At this time, we're projecting approximately $889,000 in revenues for next year. A healthy portion of that, or the majority of that, is from the assessment revenues. It's 3% that's collected on overnight stays for hotels and motels only at this time. As council is aware, we've already satisfied a portion of the renewal process that's outlined under 1989 law, Highway Code Sections 36530 to 36537. I'm not going to bore you with the details, but that outlines the information that has to be brought forward for the TBID and ultimately City Council to consider. And there's an opportunity for hoteliers and moteliers to protest. That's the public hearing process that we're concluding tonight. We have not received any protests to this point, though there's still public hearing opportunity this evening to see if we hear from anyone. So ultimately, what we're looking for is approval to continue under a 3% assessment. In addition, we are going through the process of reviewing the opportunity to bring vacation rentals and RV parks into the assessment. That's ongoing discussion. What rate it would be brought in, whether they'd have board representation on the TBID advisory board, those kind of questions are being sussed out through the public process. TBID will take this up sometime this summer and bring it back for council consideration, at which point council can decide either postpone bringing them in until next year or maybe do a mid-year adjustment, which would require going through a very similar process we're going through right now. So happy to answer any questions that council may have.
Great, thank you for that. We did hear a detailed report at the last meeting, but I will open it up for any council questions if there are council member questions. Councilmember McPherson?
I just have you answered one question, and that was when that might happen, bringing in the vacation rentals and the RV parks. And so I'm assuming if we did it mid-year, we could begin to start collecting money sooner rather than later. So I just wanted to clarify
That's
correct. Yeah. And then the only other question I had was regarding the grants, which they have now taken out of the general funding, and TBID will be responsible for that. Will the council get to see the criteria that they will be using for evaluating those grant applications?
That is an excellent question. If that's the pleasure of council kind of consensus, we certainly can go do that. They created a subcommittee, the TBID created a subcommittee, advisory board did, of two members of the TBID, several hoteliers and business folks in the community. And city staff to review the existing criteria, which isn't much of one, and really trying to figure out what's going to create the best mix of events. You know, do we want to try to pilot new events or promote new events, alcohol versus non-alcohol, gate fee versus no gate fee, nonprofit versus for-profit? All those things are being sussed out with the group, and they're making recommendations for TBID for their next TBID advisory board meeting next Thursday. So we can bring forward the request that it be brought back to council for ultimate approval before they initiate the application process. That, if that's the will of the council, I can certainly make that recommendation.
Well, I think we were concerned that since we give money to community organizations, we'd like to see consistency between the grant process for those grants and the grants that we're giving through TBID. So I guess I would be in favor of at least seeing it, even if it's just on consent.
Just looking for head nods. Yes. Interested in seeing that? Okay, yeah.
Thanks. Okay, thank you.
No problem. Okay, any other questions regarding? Seeing none, I will open the public hearing then. I'll start by asking for the record, City Clerk, are there any protests that have been received prior to the meeting this evening?
No protests have been received by my office.
Thank you. With that, I'll open up public comment. Any hoteliers in the audience and or members of the public wishing to comment on item B1, please do so at this time, especially hoteliers if there are any that would like to comment with regard to this and or protest. Now is the time to do that. Looking for general public comment as well. Seeing no hoteliers or members of the public coming forward, I will close the public hearing and bring it back to council for discussion and or a motion.
Well, I believe that we've discussed this several times previously and have seen all of this information, so I'd be prepared to make a motion. Okay. I move that we adopt Resolution Number 45-19, continuing the program and levying the assessments for the 2019-20 fiscal year for the Morro Bay Tourism Business Improvement District.
Second. So motion by Councilmember McPherson for the staff report recommendation, seconded by Councilmember Davis. Roll call vote.
Councilmember McPherson?
Yes.
Councilmember Davis?
Yes.
Councilmember Addis?
Yes.
Councilmember Heller?
Yes.
And Mayor Hedding?
Yes.
The motion carries 5-0.
Okay, that concludes this public hearing item. With that, we will move to item C-1 on the agenda. This is review of the concept design report for the water conveyance facilities project and the groundwater modeling technical memorandum for the water reclamation facility. And I'll turn it over to Mr. Casares or Livick, whomever may be coming forward. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Casares is coming to the
as we
staff
speak.
Table as we speak. And we have a PowerPoint loaded up on the projector. So this item is relating to the conveyance system, which is the pipelines and pump stations. It'll go between the existing wastewater treatment plant and the new facility and back again. And then also the results of the first phase of the groundwater modeling work that we engaged GSI in last year.
Great. Thank you, Rob. Mr. Mayor, members of council, Eric Casares, the city's WRF program manager. Thank you for having me here this evening to present on item C1, which is review of the concept design report for the water conveyance facilities project and the groundwater modeling technical memorandum, or the phase one hydrogeotechnical work, or geological, excuse me. Our recommendation here tonight is that you receive the final draft concept design report and provide comments and input on the presentation for the groundwater modeling technical memorandum. I've split the presentation into two. We'll go through the first component, which is the conveyance facilities concept design report, and we can pause there for questions, and then I can continue on with the groundwater discussion. So the first item, which is the final draft concept design report, the concept design report for the conveyance facilities portion of the WRF project, which are the as Rob mentioned, are the pipelines linking the existing wastewater treatment plant and the new water reclamation facility and the pump stations that are used to convey the sewage between those two facilities, is really meant to set the stage of the direction for this portion of the project. And the slide up here in front of you shows the sequence of events that really the designer and the city staff and the program manager went through in order to develop the preliminary design. The project started with confirming the design capacity for the lift stations and for the pipelines, going back and looking at numerous sources of information and confirming that design capacity. Then looked at pipeline optimization, looking at different pipeline sizes for the different services that we're looking at. As I mentioned, we're looking at moving the raw sewage in between the existing wastewater treatment plant, the new water reclamation facility. We also need to bring back the concentrate from the RO process back to the outfall, as well as high wet weather flows need to come back through the outfall. And then we're also running in that same or in an adjacent trench, we're also running the potable reuse pipeline to either the east or west injection location. So we did a pipeline optimization to confirm the pipeline sizes. And in the case of the force main, looked at splitting that single large raw wastewater force main into two smaller force mains to facilitate operations there. Went through an extensive routing analysis, looking at a number of different routing options between those on the west of Highway 1 as well as those on the east of Highway 1. And we can discuss those in a little bit more detail as needed. Once the routing analysis was done and the route was confirmed, a pump station analysis was completed, and as you may remember, the original direction for this portion of the project was a single large pump station that would be located down near the existing wastewater treatment plant. Through work with Waterworks engineers, identified the concept of this dual pump station option, which is something that's being evaluated as part of the final EIR addendum with the ability to reduce the cost of the overall project. Following that pump station analysis, the preferred alternative or recommended alternative was presented, and then we have since moved into the final design phase of the project, meaning we've completed the concept design report through this final draft. The final document will be submitted along with the 60% design deliverable in September, or excuse me, later in the summer. So the next phases of the work are the 60% design, which with the 60% design will come a lot more detail on the design of the pipeline and the pump stations, and will also bring more detail as it relates to traffic control and those kinds of things. And then we'll move on to the 90, the 100% deliverable, and then finally the bid submittal. Just wanted to put up a timeline here for the development of the concept design report. So this is kind of the from all the way from the cradle, essentially, of when this project was started. This component of the project started in November of 2017 with the selection of Waterworks Engineers as the preferred team to design the pipelines and pump stations. A number of design meetings were held in the spring of 2018 as Carollo came on board as a program manager. We really shored up what the preliminary design was going to look like and cost in those early stages in order to develop the cost that would then go into the rate study and was discussed in the Blue Ribbon Commission report. That was done in June of 2018. The concept design report, as it's being presented here tonight, was first brought to WRFCAC in December of 2018. And the concepts for the pipeline alignments and the pump station alternatives was presented to WRFCAC at that time, then followed up and made a similar presentation to City Council on January 22nd. Based on direction of Council, we came back on February 13th, where Council could formally take action on the selection of the the pipeline alignment and the pump station option, the dual pump station option. Then brought this back to WRFCAC on June 4th, last week, and then are coming to you here tonight on June 11th with the final CDR being delivered in September of 2019, along with the 60% design submittal. The slide I have up here is really the recommended project. As you can see, we've got the two pump stations that have been identified. Pump Station A is the original pump station location that was included in the final EIR. Pump Station B is the secondary pump station that would be located thereby on Main Street and Highway 1 next to Limos. We made a couple of pipeline alignment tweaks that are identified as the dashed lines there, a force main from lift station 2, existing lift station 2 to lift station B, and then a modification to the pipeline alignment if we do indeed go to the east injection location. Really not many changes since we presented the initial concept to WRFCAC in December and then to Council in January and February. The one change that has happened is to the schedule. So if you were to look at the concept design report when we originally presented it back in December, January, and as we look at it now, there's been a slight shift in the schedule is really the biggest change. Really, that's due to a delay in performing some of the necessary field work that we've needed to do. Really has to do with site access. We're getting over those challenges and finishing a number of those design activities in order to get the 60% delivered. We're hoping that we'll be able to catch up with the schedule as we move from the 60% into the 90% and the 100%. But these line items in the schedule show that delay of a couple of months there, again, mostly due to the access issues. So just some input from WRFCAC from last week. We got a number of really good questions and comments from folks on WRFCAC. One of the questions that was asked is the use of plastic versus metallic pipe and some of the benefits of plastic versus metallic pipe. The concept design report goes into detail on this a little bit, but there was a discussion of cost and the cost savings associated with plastic pipe versus metallic pipe. By metallic pipe, we mean either steel or ductile iron pipe, most likely ductile iron pipe in the sizes that we're talking about. And then the other question that was raised was daily production rates. As we know that these pipes are going to be running, a significant portion of the alignments running through Quintana, and will have impacts on the business district there. The discussion was had about which could be built faster, either metallic pipes ductile iron pipes with push-on joints, or the concept that we're currently moving forward with, which is the fusion welded PVC or HDPE, and really based on discussions with the design engineer and in my experience that the plastic pipe would be a faster construction. Again, we're going to be limiting kind of the pace of construction for a lot of this pipeline in order to accommodate and best avoid any the traffic impacts to Quintana there. So that was one of the things that came up. Mr. Donnelly asked a number of really good questions on some of the detailed design concepts for the pipelines, things that are going to be reflected in the 60% design submittal, you know, locations of isolation valves, some of the minimum cover requirements specifically for pipelines running in Caltrans right-of-way, and then any issues with pressure testing and the requirements around pressure testing for that pipe. Again, things that will be showing up in the specifications as we move into the 60 and 90 and 100% design levels. Another question that was asked is around traffic impacts from the pipeline realignment. As I mentioned, one of the changes that we have made to the alignment is down at the southern end of the alignment, where we were previously going to be doing a horizontal directional drill underneath Highway 1, coming up and joining there with Teresa Road. Based on some work with Caltrans, we identified that we would be able to open cut that construction underneath the overpass there at South Bay Boulevard. And so the question was asked about traffic impacts. Those are things that are going to be looked at or being currently being looked at as part of the final EIR addendum. With that, any questions on the conveyance facilities concept design report?
Any questions at this point? Yeah. Council Member Heller, sure.
Thank you for that, Mr. Casares. I have a question about the new slides here. Design capacity, which is part of that original concept work, obviously. Do you design for a future population of a certain amount, or how do you decide what capacity this system should be designed for?
So there's a number of flow studies that have been done for this project going back to really the development of the first or the previous facility master plan that was done in 2007. So there was an analysis that was done then, again, combined flows between Morro Bay and Cayucas. There was a subsequent flow study that was done by Montgomery Watson as part of the design of the previous treatment plant that was going to be located adjacent to the existing treatment plant. There was a flow analysis that was done by Black and Veatch as part of that facility master plan in 2017. A flow analysis was done during the development of the One Water Plan, and really at the end of the day ended up becoming the basis of the design and finalized what the design capacity was going to be. So just to recap that One Water, as part of the One Water Plan, the city hired a firm out of the Bay Area, Villa Lobos and Associates, that installed a number of flow meters in the collection system in order to model the flow, or excuse me, to record the flows there. A model of the collection system was developed, and that flow study data was used to calibrate the model and was ultimately what was used to confirm the necessary size of the treatment plant and the conveyance facilities.
Just to add on a little bit. Sure. So that established some per capita flows, and then we used our city's general plan for projection populations, and the design of the facilities supports the build-out of our general plan.
So the and I don't remember that number. Sorry, Mr. Leivick, but that general plan number 10 years from now?
12,200 is our population cap.
So it's sized for that population, basically?
Yeah, the general plan is, the horizon of the general plan is 2040, and that's consistent with the One Water Plan also looked at out to 2040.
Okay, thank you. One other question I have, so the two pumps, the PSB and the PSA, those are running 24/7, is that right, with backup generators, et cetera?
That's correct. So there was really three different pump station alternatives that were looked at. It was a single larger pump station down near the existing courtyard, which was the original concept. Then there were two dual pump station options that were identified. One was a fairly large pump station located at pump station A that would run all the time with a pump station located at pump station B that would only function during wet weather. And so, and then the third option was two pump stations kind of splitting the city and operating those two pump stations as really duty pump stations operating day in and day out. And that is the alternative that's recommended.
Okay. And then I guess I have another question. I'm the kind of person who likes to check things off, make lists and check them and so forth. This particular draft, final draft, et cetera, is there some way we can bring this forward sooner than August and get the thing signed off so it's not part of the next submittal? You know what I mean?
That's a good question. Based on previous discussions internally and with the design engineer, we wanted this ultimately when this concept design report gets finalized, it represents the project that's in the 60% design. So obviously as we continue forward in the development of the final design, there could be slight tweaks and changes, and any of those changes we want reflected in the concept design report when that's finalized. Because this is really going to be the last report for the pipelines and pump stations. Once we move forward past this step or this deliverable, we're then dealing with just plans and specifications, essentially.
So you need that additional time to generate that? Is that what you're saying?
It's really not the additional time. It's just that we're sitting it and putting it in a holding pattern and incorporating any changes. We just don't want to finalize. If we finalize it now, and then we're not going to deliver our 60% design for the next couple of months. If there are any changes between now, when we finalize the concept design report, and when we deliver the 60%, we would want to go back and change the concept design report to reflect what's in the 60%. So we would just end up issuing it again.
Okay.
This is the final draft that we're bringing forward now is essentially what's going to be the final document when we submit it formally with the 60% in September.
Okay.
So we're just, like I said, we're not really anticipating any changes. We're just letting it sit into a holding pattern. Very likely we might be just changing the date on the cover and resubmitting it as a final in September.
Okay.
If there are no design changes.
Okay. And then my last question really has to do with the impact of this phase of the project, which has been talked about at previous council meetings, and obviously they're concerned business owners and so forth along the pathway. And we've talked about a traffic management plan. Is there an intention on the team here to generate a traffic management plan that would be in the bid documents?
Absolutely. So we've discussed that. There's going to be an initial plan coming forth with the 60% design, and we'll continue to refine that, and ultimately that will be outlined in the plans and specifications. So as I mentioned earlier, there's different ways to handle the construction. And with certain projects, we could leave a lot of the construction up to the contractor in terms of their means and methods and not put a lot of constraints on them. That's not going to be the case with this project. In the sequence of work, we're going to have a number of – we're going to tell the contractor how we want this thing built.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, Councilmember McPherson.
Sure, thank you. And thank you very much for the report and the update. We've seen much of this before already, so it's not new to us. But I do think you might want to address Mr. Brannon's concern about the challenges to this route and whether or not we've actually studied enough alternative routes. So if you could just address that question first.
So that's a good point, and I definitely don't agree, or I definitely don't disagree with Mr. Brannon. It is a difficult construction project. There really is no slam dunk way to get from the existing wastewater treatment plant location to the new water reclamation facility. So there were essentially five alternatives, maybe five and a half alternatives that were looked at to connect the two different locations. Two of them were on the west side of the highway, what we refer to as the west alignment, which is the recommended alignment, which goes down Quintana, and then the Embarcadero alignment, which went down the Embarcadero and then came up South Bay Boulevard. Those were the two west alignments. On the east side, we had several different alignments that we looked at. Some of them were quote-unquote open-cut construction, where the contractor would go and the majority of the pipeline would be constructed based on digging a trench, putting in the pipe, and backfilling it. There was another alternative that looked at much of the construction going trenchless or horizontal directional drilling or jack and bore underneath some jurisdictional waterways and some other things. So those were kind of the five different alternatives that were looked at. Ultimately, the alternatives on the east side of Highway 1 were fatally flawed out because they had insurmountable challenges as it related to either hydraulics, so there was technical challenges. There were issues with cultural resources in that area, or biological in terms of having to cross, I think it was up to eight, for certain alignments, it was up to eight different jurisdictional waterways.
Right, so you're confident that we've studied all of the possible alternative routes for the pipeline and that we have selected the best one?
That's correct, and we've looked at, there's a couple of issues that we're dealing with. I think the biggest issues, I would say, from a technical standpoint that we have to deal with on the recommended alignment is the crossing of Little Morro Creek, so the pipe bridge crossing Little Morro Creek. We are doing that crossing in such a way that we are avoiding impacts that would require Section 401 or 404 permits. We still do need to coordinate with Fish and Wildlife on that crossing, and then we also have the wetland issue on the bike path. Again, we have a concept for coming for getting around that. One of the things we're going to be doing there is likely a trenchless crossing there, again, to avoid any of those jurisdictional issues with the 401 and the 404.
Okay, thank you. And can I just ask you to remind all of us the cost of the pipelines and the lift stations, because I know I was confused by the cost figures that were in the report, and I had a couple of constituents also ask me about it. So my understanding is you included alternatives in there. So if you could just very clearly state what the costs, the actual costs are included in the budget at this point.
Sure. So the costs that are associated with this portion of the project for the construction of these facilities, there's really three different elements as you look at some of the cost tables in that report. The first one is the pipelines themselves, the major pipelines themselves, and you're looking at the west pipeline alignment, and we have also assumed that we are going to be going to the east IPR injection location. That's what we've assumed in the original cost estimate from June of 2018 and the latest cost estimate that was developed in April of this year. It is the higher cost alternative, so we're carrying the higher cost alternative between going to the east and going to the west injection locations. So that's one component. The other component is the lift stations. So we have assumed, we assumed it when we developed the original cost back in June 2018, and there's currently the cost that we're carrying now is for the dual pump station option. So we've got the west alignment with the east injection location is one cost element. We've got the dual pump stations, and then we also have a communication conduit that we need to run along with the pipelines. It was not originally included as part of the project from the new water reclamation facility to the wastewater treatment plant. So all of those in total, the construction cost escalated to anticipated midpoint of construction of about November 2020 is right around $24 million for the construction cost only.
Okay, and that does not include the waterworks contract.
It does not include their design fee, which is we have in the estimate. We do have their design fee in the estimate. It does not include construction management. Again, that's covered other places in the estimate and other soft costs.
Okay.
But the total loaded cost for that portion of the project is included in the budget, but of that, $24 million is the hard construction cost. When we open bids on this project, we would anticipate that it would be approximately $24 million.
And would you expect the same company to be able to build both the pipelines and the lift stations? Would it be a single contract or two contracts?
The plan now is to put out one single contract for the pump station and the pipelines.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. To my left, Councilmember Davis, any questions?
Yes, I do.
I have one question.
Yes.
The notice to proceed is dated May 11th, 2020. Does that mean that construction is going to start around Memorial Day?
Excuse me. That's when the contractor notice to proceed would be issued based on the current schedule. Now, construction would start at that point and would start right around that point in time.
Okay. And then substantial completion be September 17th of 2021. So it looks as if the construction will take place over two entire tourist seasons. I thought we were going to avoid doing construction on Quintana during the busy summer season.
That's correct. We're gonna avoid doing construction on Quintana during the busy season between Memorial Day and Harbor Fest. So there's other portions of the alignment that we would construct during those periods, but that's the total construction duration. We would start construction in roughly May and end in September, October. As I mentioned, the current schedule has been delayed a little bit because of some of these access issues. So the latest scheduled date that we're tracking is around November of 2021 when that pipeline would be complete. We're hoping to do what we can to pull that up. But we are still committed to avoiding Quintana during those busy periods.
Okay.
Just to add a little bit more, in the construction documents, the bid package will prescribe a construction schedule that the contractor will need to adhere to for different phases of the project where they can work on between certain months of the year. So that'll be outlined in the advertisement to bid and the PS&Es that will go out for this job.
Okay, good. I think that's a very important aspect of this project, so thank you for that.
And just to add quickly, that's one element that's going to drive the way that we put together the sequence of work is obviously the impacts on Quintana. The other one has to do with the bike path and when school is in session, so that was the other obstacle that we're working around is trying to minimize the impacts to the high school there.
That's great. Thank you.
Great. Councilmember Addis, any questions?
I don't have questions, but I do want to thank staff for answering extensive questions via email over the weekend. So thank you for that.
Great, thank you. Eric, could you just elaborate a little bit on the delay with Vistra Energy, our new owner of the former Dynegy property? Did we give them plenty of notice, and was that just their failure to respond? Just curious. In terms of access, the access to the property?
I think that we've been working with them to get them up to speed. I think probably the biggest issue was when we initially approached them. They weren't as familiar with the project potentially as the previous owners. So a lot of it has been educating them in terms of what we're going to be doing. We had to work out what the access would look like. We had to make sure that we had insurance requirements on par with what they were requesting from all of the various sub-consultants that we have accessing the site. So in order to kind of move this phase of the project forward, not just on the conveyance facilities portion, but on the total project, I think we still have several sub-consultants that haven't gotten on site yet, but I think we have a total of six different parties that need to go on site. And so it's just taken a good deal of time to make sure that Vistra is comfortable in the work that we're going to be doing and that we had all the proper clearances and those types of things. Health and safety plans were requested, and new insurance certificates naming Vistra were required, and some other things that we had to just go through. And it's just taking quite a bit longer than what we anticipated originally.
Are the requests from Vistra unusual with regard to access issues, and are these perhaps contributing to the delay? Out of curiosity,
I think Vistra rightly had some concerns on some of the some types of work that we need to do. So, for example, we are working to get the geotechnical consultant onto their property to do some borings. So. They would consider maybe some riskier activities than maybe the surveying or sending our biologist onto their site to look at and do a wetland delineation. And so I think it's some of those activities that have kind of driven that. I don't necessarily think that it's outside of the norm. Approaching a company of this size cold and not, maybe them not knowing exactly what we were planning to do.
Okay, great. Are you familiar with the OSOS project in San Luis Obispo that's going on right now with regard to the piping that's going in across the OSOS and Higuera, from OSOS and Higuera all the way down to, I can't remember if it's Bouchon or what?
I'm not.
Okay, it may be a good case study for, I was there viewing the site for potential concerns with regard to business interruption. I know our business community is very concerned, but it to me is a good example of appropriate staging, minimization of daily work to minimize impacts, maintaining a lane open at all times for traffic, et cetera, so that there's access to the businesses, and thought it might be a good opportunity for our folks to take a look at that and just see if there are similarities that could be helpful.
No, I appreciate that, and we can reach out to our colleagues there in the city and to get some more information on that project.
Great, thank you. With that, no other questions, we'll go ahead to the second part of the presentation.
Great, thank you. So now we're going to move on to the ground modeling technical memorandum. So wanted to just refresh folks' memories on the phasing of this work. So really the hydrogeological work necessary to support the planned injection of the purified water into the Morro groundwater basin. It started with the feasibility study that was completed in 2017 by GSI. And GSI, as part of that study, they made a number of different findings in terms of the feasibility of meeting the travel time, which is the critical requirement by the Division of Drinking Water for this type of project at both the west and east injection locations. They also roughly identified the sizing of the wells and based on the amount of water that we wanted to inject. They had identified the number of wells that would likely need to be used for injection, as well as a couple of other recommendations there. And then we moved forward. The city put out a request for qualifications to the community and got back a number of proposals. One of them being from GSI. GSI was ultimately selected to continue the hydrogeological work. That hydrogeological work is really split into three phases. What we're presenting here tonight are the results of the phase one work. So the phase one, and I'll talk a little bit about phase two and phase three as we move forward here. So really the phase one work includes investigating the pumping of the city's full permitted allotment of 581 acre feet per year without injection. So this was something that came up really last year as we were working on the One Water Plan and looking at some different water supply options for the city. I wanted to look at kind of a baseline condition of if the city did not receive its state water allocation and had to result on more groundwater pumping than it currently does, then what would happen to the water quality in the groundwater basin if the city were to try to pump its full allotment of 581 acre feet? So that was something that we wanted to answer as kind of a baseline condition. We also wanted to look at the impacts of injection and extraction on the groundwater basin as it relates to two important constituents. The first one is the nitrate levels in the groundwater. So as was discussed previously, the Morro groundwater basin has a history of nitrate contamination. And so what happens to those nitrate concentrations with injection and extraction? And then again, looking at the groundwater chemistry as it results to seawater intrusion. So as you pump more groundwater, those wells are close to the coastline. What happens to the salinity content in the water that's being extracted? Really, the first and third bullet points are comparable to each other. So the first bullet point is, hey, what happens if we just pump more groundwater? And the third bullet point is really, hey, if we pump more groundwater and inject, is there a different outcome? Excuse me. So this slide here shows the groundwater, the lower Morro groundwater basin, and you can see the contour lines here, and roughly see what the groundwater basin looks like. So in terms of the information that was used to do the analysis, pumping data between 1965 and 2018 from seven different wells was used to construct and calibrate the model. TDS and nitrate data going back to the early 1980s was used as well. And really it was a combination of two different modeling softwares. Really the ModFlow model that was developed as part of the feasibility study was an add-in. ModPath was used to be able to do particle tracking. So it's really building upon work that GSI has previously done. And that's kind of the theme as we discussed the phase one work, phase two and phase three. It's a continual update and refinement of the modeling activities as we move forward. So the first question, the impacts of pumping on seawater intrusion. Again, the model was developed by GSI, and they looked at 581 feet, acre feet per year extraction without any kind of injection. The simulation was run over a 38-year simulation period. And based on that simulation, after that 38-year period, the TDS concentration in the groundwater basin was between 5,000 and 17,000 milligrams per liter. And just to note, the secondary MCL for drinking water for this constituent is 1,000 milligrams per liter. So really the takeaway here is that the Morro groundwater basin is at risk of seawater intrusion with increased pumping. So under this scenario, much like today, if the city needed to pump its total allotment of 581 acre feet year after year after year, it's a good probability that we'd start to see seawater intrusion. So that really answers that first bullet point and the baseline of what happens with more pumping without injection. We then moved on to the injection scenarios. These are the modeled injection well locations. GSI refers to the different injection locations as the south side, which we refer to as the west side or the west injection location in our reports, and then the narrows area, which we refer to as the east injection location. Those naming conventions were developed and used as part of the recycled water feasibility study, and we've continued to use east and west moving forward here. So those two things are synonymous, west and south side and east and narrows. And you can see those here on the four wells in each location. So first looking at the impacts of injection on nitrates, the graph here to the left shows the historical nitrate concentration, and there's a red line here that'll give you reference. The primary drinking water MCL, or maximum contaminant limit for nitrates, is 45 milligrams per liter as nitrate. So you can see that the historical nitrate concentrations, the calibrated model showed the historical nitrate concentrations at over the primary MCL, which fits with what the current city currently does. It extracts water from the lower Morro groundwater basin when necessary and runs it through its water treatment plant or its brackish water reverse osmosis plant. And then you can see the graph here to the right shows the response to the groundwater basin, and this is well MB4 specifically as it relates to the pumping activity, to the injection and extraction activities. And you can see that the nitrate concentration under most scenarios, the narrows and the east and the west alternatives, is below the primary drinking water MCL for nitrates. We then look at TDS, or seawater intrusion. Again, you can see the historical TDS concentrations in the wells. Again, looking at MB4 as an example. And you can see the secondary MCL is about 1,000 milligrams per liter. And as you can see on the right-hand side, the green and blue lines are below that drinking water MCL, secondary MCL. Uh, So that's really the outcomes of the phase one work. So again, sustained pumping without injection could put the city at risk for seawater intrusion. And then really the benefits of injection on is that it will help off-put seawater intrusion and would help bring the nitrate concentrations from above the primary MCL to below the primary MCL. So that's really the big high-level takeaways from the phase one work. And I do have David O'Rourke here from GSI who's available to help answer questions as we move on from this part of the presentation. So just a real quick update on the phase two status. So as I mentioned, this is a continuum of additional hydrogeological investigation, and we're really in the field work stage now. We're doing evaluations of the injection location. So several weeks ago, some cone penetration tests were done in the east area. To do a high-level analysis of the feasibility of injecting water in the east area. Based on the results of that, the east area is still in the running, meaning the conditions underground are suitable based on the evaluation that was completed for injection. So that was that's some recent information that we've gotten back. We're also in the process of preparing the test well design and permitting, looking at doing some work on both the east and west areas as it relates to this, looking to install a piezometer, which is essentially something that will allow us to see the groundwater levels in response to pumping in that area. We're looking to install that on Errol Street very soon. And then planning to do some pump testing for the city's well MB13. So the plan is we do pump testing and we see what the response is in the piezometer or at that location, and that helps us better define the parameters of the model. In the west area, we're currently working with Vistra. They have a work plan that was developed by GSI that they're currently reviewing, which includes either the construction of a new pilot well or use of one of their existing Morro Bay Mutual Water Company wells to be able to do a fairly similar exercise on the west side as we're doing on the east side. We're going to do some pump testing at that well and then monitor what happens with the groundwater elevations as we do that pump testing. And then the city has been, GSI has been conducting seawater intrusion monitoring or level monitoring in the city's existing seawater extraction wells that are that the city constructed to facilitate the desalination facility. That's been ongoing. Some pressure transducers were installed in those wells by GSI back in December of 2018, and they're continuing to get data on the seawater levels there. And very similar work was done on the city's existing groundwater wells. Again, pressure transducers are installed there, and they get constant information on the water levels in those wells. Those were installed back in December 2018. The idea is that we will continue to get groundwater and seawater level information from now through the construction of the injection wells. Input from WRFCAC. So again, this report was presented to WRFCAC last week, and I would say that based on our notes, the focus of the WRFCAC input and public comment at that point in time was really the source of nitrate contamination and where that nitrate contamination was coming from. So I do want to say that the nitrate contamination, just kind of setting that aside for a second, the source of the nitrate contamination or where the nitrate contamination is coming from really did not have an impact on the work that GSI did. So GSI is looking to model what's actually going on in the groundwater basin, and they're not really looking at what that source of the nitrate contamination is. It's really what's the fate of it in the future. I did clip a couple of excerpts from a report that was developed by Cleethan Associates in 2007. That's been referenced a number of different times, looking at the source of nitrate contamination in the Morro groundwater basin. And so I just highlighted a couple of parts here. Essentially, that report started off with the premise that a number of different activities could be the cause of the nitrate contamination in the Morro groundwater basin. They started off looking at turf fertilizers, private septic tanks, animal operations, and other miscellaneous sources could be you know, a source of contamination. They quickly ruled those out, and the focus was put on sewer exfiltration as well as agricultural activities in upstream. And so, reading on in that report, I clipped something else from the conclusions there, and you can see highlighted sewer exfiltration was not a major source of nitrate contamination in groundwater at the city wellfield. Again, this is taken from the Cleith report that was developed in 2007. And then the last item is a third clip that was taken. It says the results of the study indicate that the main source of nitrate contamination in groundwater at the city's Highway 1 well field is from nitrogen fertilizer application associated with vegetable farming operations in the lower Moro Valley. So just wanted to just simply stating the conclusions that were made by that registered hydrogeologist from Cleith and Associates back in that report.
Not only by the hydrogeologist at Cleith and Associates, but the Regional Water Quality Control Board has received those reports and concurs with the findings. We were, a couple years ago, were asked to do some additional work for the regional board based on citizen input at the regional board meeting. And similar conclusions were drawn that the nitrate contamination is due to application of high nitrate fertilizer in the Upper Moro Valley, which should, with adoption of the statewide agricultural order, which requires agricultural operations to only use the amount of fertilizer that is necessary for their crop production, should see a decrease in nitrate levels in our wells. And in fact, we have seen that decrease as suspect areas that have had nitrate contamination have gone fallow. We see lesser nitrates reported in our wells.
And just to conclude, again, the recommendation here this evening from staff is that you receive the final draft concept design report, as well as providing comments and input on the presentation for the groundwater modeling technical memorandum. And with that, any additional questions?
Great, thank you. Start to my left here. Yes, Dawn.
I just have one main question. It seems like a lot rides on the accuracy of the modeling. And when GSI was chosen, they were chosen from multiple firms or contractors that could have done this modeling, and if you could talk just a tiny bit about their qualifications and why they were specifically chosen and what kind of faith you have that their modeling is correct.
And I'm trying to remember back, it was right before we were brought on board, but the RFP was developed and sent. And the city received, I believe, two proposals. One of them was from GSI, and the other was from a well-qualified firm. As far as the reason for selecting GSI, again, their qualifications, GSI has a lot of experience, not only in the region with groundwater here in the immediate area as well as in the county, but they're also involved in a number of these potable reuse projects in California. So these injection and extraction projects are not, they're become more commonplace, but there aren't that many that have been completed, and there are a number that are in currently in process, and GSI has experience specifically with those types of projects. So not only their local experience, their history with the development of the feasibility study, but then their specific experience on actual indirect potable reuse projects is ultimately why they were selected.
Good. Okay, Red.
Thank you for this report. In the technical memorandum, there is reference to a seawater intrusion event in the early 1990s. And it looks as if it affected MB3 and MB4. Do we have any historical information as to what might have caused that?
Based on my recollection of the early 1990s, I was working in the area. We were going through drought at that time. We, in Morro Bay, I was working for another city, but in Morro Bay, the source of water was two well fields, the Morro and the Choro well fields. We were severe. The city was pumping those very actively. State water was not yet available, and it was the only source of water. There were, that's where you see in the existing code, very draconian measures were developed for water conservation. Comes out of that same time period. So it was drought and a very active pumping of the basin.
Okay. And then Mr. Sadowski raised the question about the effect of sea level rise as regards saltwater intrusion into the aquifer. Do we have any information on that, or is there any way to model for that?
Yeah, that question was actually asked during at WRFCAC as well. So it's something that we're going to be looking at as we move forward into the phase two and we continue to refine the model. We'll be looking at and I think this is one of the questions that was previously received as well. We're going to be looking at a number of different injection and extraction scenarios, as well as looking at different sea level rise situations consistent with the city's local coastal plan and making sure that those are looked at in detail.
Okay, thanks. That's all I have.
Okay. Marlis?
Thank you. Thank you very much. Just a couple questions here. First of all, how many wells, injection wells, at this point are you anticipating that we're going to need?
So the feasibility study looked at a range of different injection and extraction alternatives. So there were some different numbers that were put out there. Now, the city can physically only produce at the very maximum about 800 acre feet per year based on the amount of water that's coming in the door that can go out to the injection fields. The current costs and the current assumptions are based around four wells. But as we move through and really as we get into the phase three hydrogeological work, so phase two, I think I went into detail on phase two. Phase two is really determining which is the better injection location, east or west, and then also kind of getting that final the final definitive answer on our travel time that we're going to put into our what we call our Title 22 engineering report. That'll go to the Division of Drinking Water, and that will is what they'll use to evaluate and ultimately develop the permit for the city. So that's really the phase two. Phase three is where GSI is going to look and say, okay, we're going to put 825 or around 800 acre feet into the ground. Based on the model, based on the geotechnical information that we have, we think that we can, you know, the maximum capacity for each well will be X. And based on that, you're going to need three wells or four wells. Each of those wells is going to have a 18-inch or 12-inch diameter casing or whatever that is, and it's going to be drilled to this depth. It's going to be screened at these different depths, and really giving the really the design details for then the design engineer to go and design the well based on those parameters.
So I recall that you once mentioned the travel time as being a critical issue, and at this point, are you just assuming that this can be done with the model, or are you thinking that we would actually have to do some testing of that?
So there's a couple of different things. Is one of the benefits of having the pilot injection wells is it allow the city to do a tracer study if it needs to. So again, the travel time and the regulations as DDW has developed them are a little bit nuanced. But based on the different level of sophistication of your travel time determination methods, you get more and more credit. So, for example, a groundwater model such as this will get you 50% credit, meaning if your groundwater model says that you're going to get 4 months of travel time in the groundwater, Division of Drinking Water will look at that and say, okay, great, your model says you'll get four. We're going to base our permit on 2 months, and 2 months is the minimum. So it just all depends on how close we get to that four-month period if we go to the next step and we go through and do a tracer study. Now, when the facility does go online, when it's going online full scale, it will be required to do a tracer study, as all potable reuse projects need to. This would just give us an additional level of confidence earlier that we're able to meet the minimum travel time if we do the tracer study during the design process. And the cost for that tracer study, the cost for the injection wells, all of those have been included in the existing project budget.
Okay. And at what point do you determine how much water you're going to extract? Is that part of the study as well?
That's going to be part of the phase two as well, yeah.
Part of phase two. Okay. And the wells, you mentioned that the east are at least favored at this point. But depending on which ones you go with, the west or east, it will require land acquisition. Is that correct? Which I assume we have not done yet.
That's correct. So just a slight correction. I think you said east is our preferred, west is our preferred. So we are using east in our cost model.
Oh, I see.
So
we've
based our cost assumption on east, which is the worst case scenario from a cost perspective. So we're hoping that we can go to the east, and so that we can reduce costs below what we currently have, what we have budgeted. The reason for that really is that the pipeline length is shorter,
right,
going to the west, and it will require some land acquisition. And as it currently stands, the west and the east, neither one of those injection locations are located in, you know, city-owned property. So part of that is Vistra property, and part of it is private property.
And the west is the Vistra property.
That's correct.
Okay, I think those are all my questions. Thanks.
Great, thank you. Jeff?
I have a few.
Sure.
First of all, I'd like to thank the staff for this report. It's a really excellent staff report. It's highly technical, but it's only 5 pages long with links to the backup source documents, and it's exactly what I like to see, and I just want to thank you all for that. I know there's a great effort goes into make a technical report this succinct and comprehensible, but I want you to know I really appreciate it. The 2017 report that GSI did regarding injection feasibility, so the findings are that it's likely feasible for the aquifer to accept the recycled water, right?
That's correct. That's the wording from that report.
Okay. And a minimum of 4 injection wells would likely be needed. Up to 1,200 acre-feet per year would be produced. Is that? Now, we have a limit of 581. Is that correct?
That's correct. That 581 is based on no injection. However, we work with the state to essentially be able to extract the 581 plus up to whatever the city puts into the ground. Really, the limit on the extraction amount. So just a couple of numbers really quickly. So 581 is what the city currently has permitted that it can pull from the groundwater basin. The city's current potable water demand is around 1,000 to 1,100. The build-out demand is around 1,400. So keep those couple of numbers in mind. You've got 581. You've got ultimately what the city could need is a 1,400 acre feet per year of potable water. And then the other number to remember is 800. 825 is the number we've been using, but just for round numbers, 800. And so that is the quantity of water if the city treats every drop of dry weather flow that's coming into the door of the wastewater treatment plant and puts it into the ground, it can do about 825 acre feet per year.
Okay. Just to add a little to that. So the 581 is based on a permit from the State Water Resources Control Board for our water right as an appropriator out of that basin. So we have an appropriative right for that 581, or a permit for that 581. We don't have a right for it yet. We have to prove that right out over a 30-year time period. The 800 or 825 that we'll be ejecting in the ground, that's not subject to water rights because it is water that basin hasn't seen. So we don't need to appropriate that water per California's water rights regulations, laws. So we can extract legally, have a right to all of that water, as opposed to only 581 of the basin's yield for the natural occurring water in the basin.
So you have the right to the 581 plus the 800?
Right, yeah. We don't know that we can actually produce that amount. That's what this follow-on work will do. But we have a water right to that amount.
Okay. Yeah, well, you know, there's really a balancing act between we don't want to draw, and this is the kind of stuff that we're going to be looking at phase two, is extracting the 580, you know, being able to meet the total 1,400 acre-feet per year potable water demand could be problematic because of the inducing seawater intrusion. So we want to extract as much as the city can without creating any detrimental effects from seawater intrusion.
Okay. Thank you for that. That's very clear. And I'll see.
Yeah, actually, the feasibility study, I think, looked at a range, and the feasibility said maybe up to 1,200, right?
Yeah. Okay. I'm obviously not a hydrogeologist, but I just want to share with everyone what I think an acre foot is, and please correct me if I'm wrong, gentlemen, but I think it's about the size of a football field, 1 foot deep. Is that kind of correct?
Okay. Yeah.
My level of understanding of hydrogeology is what an acre foot looks like. So I just wanted to share that, because we talk about acre feet a lot, obviously, with this issue. So as a public official who's not an expert, have you heard of the DUDEC report? You probably have, from 2017, and that was a recycled water feasibility study that the city paid for in 2012. And it states in that report that the feasibility of implementing a GRRP, replenishment of the groundwater, in the subject groundwater basins is limited due to the physical constraints of the basins, which consist of thin alluvial aquifers that offer only seasonal storage capacity during drier periods. So I'm thinking it sounds like this won't work, but the GSI report says the capacity is there, and you can actually put 800 acre feet per year into the ground. So can you explain to me the difference, or why I should believe you and not them, or are these apples and pears, or can you help me out with that?
I believe it's apples and pears. They're kind of related, but not entirely. DUDEC's work was based on a survey of existing literature. No modeling work was performed. They also assumed that the getting the water into the ground would be percolation basins. And during the feasibility study, the work that GSI did, along with their predecessor Fugro, showed that really percolation basins, there's not enough percolable soil out in the Morrow Basin to really make that a feasible option, and the only way to get the water into the ground is through groundwater injection.
Okay, that explains a lot. I appreciate that. So the phase two work that GSI is going to be doing, or has started doing, will that determine the capacity of the basin in terms of how much it'll actually contain?
There's a couple of big, essentially the big takeaways from the phase two work will be west or east, which is the preferred. Both being equal, the west would be probably the alternative that we would go with because of the lower cost. Number two, it would say how much can be extracted. We know how much can be put in, how much can be ultimately be extracted without creating issues with seawater intrusion. Over a number of different scenarios, some of those things that will be layered into that analysis will be the looking at different sea level rise scenarios.
Okay, so when phase two is done, we'll kind of know the capacity,
where it's going to go,
okay,
how many wells, and what the capacity, how much produced water is going to be coming out.
Gotcha. Now there was something else in your memorandum here that kind of stuck out, and in previous discussions about putting water in the ground and taking it out, I always had the understanding that that water had to have an additional treatment when it came out of the ground, whether that's the RO brackish water
equipment that we have now or some other treatment before it could be blended with our water system. But there's a statement in here that says water extracted by the city wells will be pumped directly into the potable water distribution system. So that seems different to me. Is that really what's going to happen?
So there were a number of, and again, this goes back to some of the things that were covered in the One Water Plan that was done last year, and looking at these different drinking water scenarios, the hope has always been that the injection practice and then subsequent extraction from the Morrill groundwater basin would be able to dilute the nitrates below the primary MCL, and we wouldn't have to treat. So the city currently runs the brackish water RO facility really to be able to bring the nitrates down below a level that's acceptable to the Division of Drinking Water, mainly below that 45 milligram per liter.
So number. Is that a hope that this will happen, or is this something you can say, yeah, this is really going to happen, we're not going to have to treat it again?
That was if you could frame, you know, why we did the phase one work, the reason for the phase one work was to answer that specific question, which is, what happens when we take this highly purified water and we put it into the ground, into a groundwater basin that we know has had historical nitrate contamination issues? What do we get when we pull that water out of the ground? And is that water going to meet the drinking water requirements, or are we going to have to continue to operate the existing water treatment plant? And the conclusion from this report is, when we put it into the ground, it mixes with the purified water, which has very little nitrates in it at all, mixes with the nitrate water in the groundwater basin, you pull it out, and it's going to be acceptable to Division of Drinking Water and won't need to be treated.
Okay. And I'm not going to ask you to predict the future, but my concerns about this approach in general is that, and there's a lot of papers and arguments about where the nitrates came from, et cetera, in the future, if the groundwater becomes more polluted for whatever reason, isn't it possible that we'll have to then treat this water that we take out of the ground? And again, I'm not asking you to predict the future, but the whole concept to me just seems kind of squishy, because this combined with possible sea level rise and this, you know, the seawater intrusion, there's so many variables to me that can happen over time. I'm just not super comfortable with this approach. But what are your thoughts about that?
That's a good point, and I think it goes back to what Rob mentioned earlier, is that based on the report that was done by Cleef, and their conclusion that the result was from the fertilizer from the agricultural practices. As Rob mentioned, the state board now has the ag order, which limits the fertilizer, the way that fertilizer can be applied. So if using that string of thought, if the nitrate contamination is a result of agricultural practices, as the Cleef report anticipated, the assumption is that those same ag practices would not repeat themselves in the future, because there are now regulations to prevent that the use of fertilizer was seen in the 80s.
Okay. Now, the cost per acre foot to generate this water, let's say that it doesn't have to be treated after you pull it out of the ground, how does that compare to the cost per acre foot for the state water that we get?
I'd have to go back to, I think the best source of that comparison would be the One Water Plan. I have to go back and look at that. I don't recall what the cost is off the top of my head. I will tell you that the cost for this water is going to be more expensive than the city currently pays for state water.
So is the plan then to use this as a backup system if there's a need during a drought, or if there's a catastrophic failure of the state water system and we need water desperately, and we would extract the water out under those circumstances only?
Under the current framework that state water exists in, with the limited opportunity to be able to sell that water or exchange that water, that's the scenario that we would be looking at. Now, there's a lot of discussion about that potentially changing, so that the city could continue to take its state water allocation and do something with it that's more lucrative than what it currently can do, which is give it back to the state at a very reduced rate. But in the short term, that is the concept until the rules governing how state water can be handled would be changed.
Okay.
Yeah, I would like to, for me, I would like to know the cost at some point. You don't have to have it at your fingertips, but I would like to know the cost of producing the recycled water, assuming it's not being treated.
After it comes out of the ground,
and a possible spitball number, if you do have to treat it, what that would cost.
The One Water Plan has a bunch of different scenarios for treating or not treating the groundwater, depending on what's in the groundwater, both from the Moro and Choro groundwater basins. It has the cost for seawater desalination. It has the cost for IPR, both with and without post-treatment. So I can get you the relevant cost tables from that report.
Okay. I keep thinking about the comment made by Mr. Sadowski about sea level rise and how that might impact the seawater intrusion issue and a number of other factors underground that could become risk factors for us. And again, we can't predict the future, but it's another issue that concerns me that just makes me kind of uncomfortable with this approach. And if we're going to spend $12 million on this, I just want it to work for a long time. That's all I have. Thank you very much for answering my questions.
Great. Thank you. I have no further questions. You asked all the questions I had, so I appreciate that. With that, I will open it up for public comment. Any member of the public wishing to come forward can do so at this time. I do have one speaker slip, Larry Truesdale. Larry, welcome.
Hello, Council and staff. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I presented the analysis of the GSI technical memo to the WRFCAC meeting last Tuesday. That report has now been forwarded and submitted to this Council. It's important you read that. In the intervening week, I have been challenged as not being qualified to analyze such a technical matter. I beg to differ. I have degrees in chemistry and economics. I have run a large multidisciplinary research group and have overseen $100 million collaborations. Since retiring nearly 9 years ago, I have been an editor for a prestigious international chemistry journal. Among the responsibilities are analyzing about 100 major research reports every year to confirm the data meets the highest scientific standards and supports the author's conclusions. Only then does it go out for peer review and possible publication. The GSI memo has significant scientific deficiencies. Among them are speculation on the nitrate source of the Morro Bay well field is definitely not supported by the data. The data does support human sewage as the major source of nitrates, contrary to what you've been hearing. The GSI flow model of the unconstrained aquifer does not include the channels sewage must take to the well. MTB migrated into the well field, so these paths need to be delineated and evaluated in any water flow analysis. Third, the MTB point source for contamination is known. The sewage in the well field likely followed the same or a similar path as MTBE. Likewise, for the sucrose contamination, speculation farms are its source is absurd. Sucralose is not used in any farming purpose, and the human population in the Morro Creek Valley is small compared to the combined population of Cayucas and North Morro Bay. With measured sucralose levels of 150 to 175 ppm, no farm-related activity could account for such an activity. Fourth, the fact the well field is contaminated with human sewage eliminates any consideration of using it for recycled water. Safe potable water cannot have sewage in it at any level. What has been proposed is an untenable strategy to recycle water for human consumption. A plan B is needed. The city's arguments, this is fifth point, city's arguments for the lack of exfiltration are contradictory and do not agree with the data. Again, the gravity feeds sewage lines in the North Morro Bay are buried in sand and gravel trenches, gravel-lined trenches. Leaks into these materials provide a migratory path of low resistance heading south. This path floods during wet spells and drains during dry areas. The GSI model must be refined to distinguish two possible nitrate-laden water flows and account for their possible mixing. And you'll have to read the last one because I don't have time unless you want me to finish the last
one. I was giving you time, Larry. Go ahead.
Okay. So finally, the recycled water is expensive. The GSI memo underestimates the amount of recovered water necessary to utilize the Morro Bay well field. A loss of half the water would double its already prohibitive cost. Desal water is less expensive and would not be contaminated with human sewage. A cost analysis of the refurbished and existing desal plant compared to the proposed GSI water recycling scheme is urgently needed. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry. Appreciate that. Public comment is still open for item C-1. Any members of the public wishing to come forward, please do so now. Welcome, Dan.
Hello, I'm Dan Sedley. I live in Morro Bay. As co-chairperson for the Citizens for Affordable Living, and for the record, I formally oppose this public input that is not being recorded and is not an official hearing that the city is required to provide, but to date they have not yet done so. The workshops provided by the city also cannot be considered official hearings by the city and should not be referred to as official hearings. Accepting community input is not the same as an official hearing. Denying an official hearing has the appearance that the city is avoiding admitting that there is a significant dissenting viewpoint by many citizens on record, one example being the approximately 2,000 Proposition 218 votes against the WRF rate increase. It is for these reasons that I am not further commenting on this WRF project during this input system, meaning public input. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. Public comment is open. Welcome, Nancy.
Good evening, Nancy Bast, longtime resident. To follow up on what Mr. Dan has just said, could someone explain to us, to me and the audience, the difference legally in the in what people say at a business under the heading of a business meeting on the agenda and what a public hearing is? It's my understanding that in a public hearing that what people say are qualified for legal opposition in a case where testimony under business items is not. And in the 6 years that we have been listening to these reports on the WRF, we have had only one public hearing, and that was to certify the EIR. All the rest of the opposing viewpoints that have been expressed have been under business agendized item. And I would appreciate if we had a legal interpretation of the difference between a testimony in a public hearing and testimony under a business item. Thank you.
Thank you, Nancy. Public comment is still open. Any members of the public wishing to come forward on item C1, please do so now. Surveying the audience and waiting. Seeing no one coming forward, I'll close public comment, bring it back to council. This is a receive final concept design report. Provide any comments with regard to presentation of the modeling
technical memorandum and accept public comment, which we have done. First, I'll ask perhaps our city attorney to explain the difference between a public hearing and a business item, if you could. I'd appreciate that. And if Mr. Collins can remind us on the number of public hearings we've had regarding this issue, that would be helpful as well. Thank you.
Sure. That's a good question. The distinction between a public meeting or business item and public hearing is sometimes lost. A public hearing is a specially required legal mandate where the item is going to be considered part of an official record that could go before a court of law. And so that's why when we just had the public hearing, for example, on item B1, the public hearing was opened and testimony was taken then. Any correspondence could be submitted then, and then it was closed. And so the items received during that public hearing when it's open are considered part of a legal record. In contrast, a business meeting is most items that come before a city council, like this receive and file that we just had, when ordinances are considered, resolutions, contracts are considered. And there really are not that many legal requirements for quote-unquote public hearings. Usually it's for permit approvals or matters involving money, like item B1.
Thank you, Chris. Appreciate that. And Mr. Collins, a number of public hearings we've had on this issue or item?
Yeah, so the Planning Commission had a joint meeting with WRFCAC last year for the EIR. That was a public hearing. And then, as Nancy mentioned, there was a public hearing for council to review the final EIR. And then there was the public hearing for the Prop 218 last year and in 2015, which also helped support the WRF project. And the Coastal Commission will be a public hearing for the Consolidated Coastal Development Permit in July in San Luis Obispo County. We've submitted our application for that, and once we know when it'll be agendized, when the item will be heard, and relative time, we'll put that on the city website.
Great. Thank you for that information. Appreciate that. With that, I'll bring it back to council and open it up for any discussion. Again, we're looking for any input or comments on the presentation regarding groundwater modeling or the final draft concept design report. So with that, no action required this evening, obviously. Anybody like to start us off looking anyway? Any discussion item? No? No?
I don't have anything to add to what we've already talked about.
Okay.
No.
All right. Councilmember Hiller, nothing to add. So.
Excuse me, I tried to get here for public comment. I have
Roger, you missed it, but guess what?
One
I'm going to open it up and allow you 3 minutes for public comment. Sir, sorry you were a little bit late. No worries.
Glad
you're here.
Thank you, Roger Ewing. I appreciate that.
You bet.
Mr. Mayor, I have just one question,
sure,
which may point out my ignorance. Is there any reason why we can't turn the water, that the purified water from the WRF right back into the system instead of putting it in the ground, letting it circulate, letting it go into the aquifer? Why not just immediately put it in the system? Just Great. A suggestion and a question.
Great. Thank you, Roger. Great question. And I'll go ahead and allow staff to respond to that. I think that he's referring to DPR versus IPR, but I'll let you be the expert, and as you are, and I'm not. Mr. Casares?
Yeah, so that would be referred to as potable reuse via surface water augmentation, essentially. So, and I agree, and I think that the hope is eventually a number of the indirect potable reuse projects, including the one for the city, may turn into a direct potable reuse project in the future. The reality is that the regulations just aren't there to really allow that. There are a couple of cities, Ventura being one of them, that is pursuing a direct potable reuse project, and it's just the timing is not right for it. But I think eventually, and the regulations are being developed now. The way that the current regulatory outlook is that. People are looking at doing a similar process to what we're looking at here. The water coming out of the advanced treatment facility would then go into a reservoir, which would go through a water treatment plant and then into the system. But a direct tap into the city's potable water system is that's going to be quite a number of years off.
Okay, thank you for that answer to that question. With that, there was no discussion or further input. Staff, thank you for your presentations and the ongoing report. Very well done. Appreciate the detailed background information as well. And with that, we will close item C-1 and take a 5-minute health break. Be back in 5 minutes. Thank you. All right, welcome back. We're ready. All right, welcome back. Back from our public health break here. We are moving to item number C-2 on the agenda this evening. This is an item for adoption of resolution number 46-19, adopting the fiscal year 2019-2020 operating capital budgets. And resolution number 4719, adopting the city's salary schedule, and resolution 48-19, rescinding and replacing resolution number 03-16, defining the management of tourism promotions and marketing. With that, I will turn it over to Ms. Calloway, our Director of Finance. Welcome.
Thank you. Good evening. This is the final leg of our budget marathon that we've been conducting over the past month. I didn't prepare a PowerPoint. I think we've PowerPointed enough on budget. And I'm just going to give a brief overview of what's included in the final proposed budget. Before I do that, I do want to, again, thank the CFAC committee for all of their work on this. Our budget and finance manager, and all of our city staff, because it truly is a group effort to get this accomplished and get this out. So in the proposed budget that you have before you, there's been 3 study sessions presented to council. It's been presented to CFAC at 2 meetings, both April and May. We've included revised capital projects for Morro Creek restoration, which shows it funded to the extent that we have grant money or dedicated funds on hand with impact fees. We've expanded the scope of the Vets Hall project, which was per council request at one of our study sessions, to include more than just the audiovisual component upgrade piece. Staff's going to continue to explore additional options with that project. So we haven't transferred the government impact fees to fund that project at this point, but it would come back to council for future appropriation. We've also added a unfunded capital project for Surf Street Stairs on page I-64 of the budget. In section A, the background section A-25 includes the budget and financial policy section, which is new in this edition and was not in the previous editions. We'll be adding the approved salary schedules should the council be approve that with this item, and also add the GAN limit appropriation, which will come at the next meeting. So those will be included in the final document when we publish the adopted version. We've also added a triangle lot page, G-55, and our adopted policies that we embarked on throughout this past year in the reference section beginning at J-15. Per council's direction at the last council meeting, the investment policy is included in the budget in the reference section. We've added a section on social responsibility based on the conversation and discussion that we heard at the council meeting. We expanded that to be environmentally sound practices, fair labor practices, and equality in broad language, and again, not to the extent that it impacts our yield and liquidity. However, if there's an even balanced investment option, we would prefer that over the other. So that language has been added into the investment policy included in the budget and would be approved if you approve the budget tonight. There's a salary salary schedule with Resolution 47-19. The MOUs that have been negotiated with our labor groups, the Firefighters Association, Police Officers Association, and Employees Association, included a 2% increase if certain budget revenue triggers were met for property tax, sales tax, and TOT. That is a combined total of those of almost $4 million. Per the language in those MOUs, if we have reasonable expectations to meet those by June 1st, we should proceed with implementing those effective July 1. We do expect to exceed those revenue options at this point, so we're proposing and have included the 2% increases for all of the employees in those associations, as well as the confidential management, department directors, and city managers. So that's all included in that salary schedule if you were to adopt that tonight. And then lastly, there's a third resolution for our tourism bid, and that is refining the contribution to $60,000 as per council direction. So with that very quick summary, I'll answer any questions that you may have.
Great. Thank you, Jen. And we just as a reminder, we have had, two budget work sessions, a 10-year plan session, and also a revenue opportunity session as well. So we've had great opportunity to get information and also meet with you and discuss that. But I will open it up for questions. Any questions at this time? Yes, Red.
I do only have one question. I was very impressed with today's story in the Tribune about the city of San Luis Obispo's plan to prepay their CalPERS obligation over a series of years in order to save on the ultimately on total interest costs. And of course, recognizing that they do have a two-year $400 million budget, and we don't. I recall that the mayor talked about this a little bit, a prepayment plan, during our goal-setting session, and I'm wondering if this is something that we can actively look at for future years.
Absolutely. So there, at our next council meeting, we are tentatively scheduling a follow-up on our revenue discussion with the items that the council asked to bring back. In July, we're scheduling a study session on our fee study update. And then following that, we'll be having a conversation about our CalPERS options. One of the challenges is to have identified funding to put towards that. So it makes sense to have a little bit of discussion about revenue options first, and then some of the options for paying down, whether it's a fresh start, i.e. reducing that mortgage period to 30 to 20 or 15 years, making payments on our own, or there's a variety of options we could pursue.
Super. Thank you very much.
Great. Any other questions? No? If not, I will open it up for public comment on item C-2. Any member of the public wishing to come forward, please do so at this time. Public comment is open. Searching. It's down, I see. Okay, with that, seeing nobody come forward, I will close public comment and bring it back for discussion and or comments that you may have regarding this year's budget in the future, and then entertain a motion. So I'll do either first, whoever would like to move and or discuss.
I'm ready to move.
All
go
right.
Ahead,
sir.
I'd like
move?
To discuss.
Oh. Yeah, well, I'll open it up for discussion if he makes
absolutely.
A motion. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I move the council adopt resolution number 46-19, authorizing the fiscal year 2019/20 operating and capital budgets, including any amendments approved by the council prior to the adoption of that resolution, and adopt resolution number 47-19, approving the FY 2019/20 salary schedule, and adopt resolution number 48-19, rescinding and replacing resolution number 03-16, defining the management of tourism promotions and marketing to establish a $60,000 general fund contribution for FY 2019/20.
Second.
Motion by Councilmember Davis for the staff recommendation, second by Councilmember McPherson, and I will open it up for any discussion that we might have. Councilmember Hiller, please.
Now's time for discussion.
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. Great report, Ms. Galloway, as usual. You're doing a great job. In the context that we're in relative to our financial condition, there's a little glitch that kind of gets under my skin, and that's the 2% raise. I think the public is looking to us to cut expenses, freeze increases, those kinds of things. And as we get closer to putting something on a ballot, I think those kinds of things will help us. I'm just saying that because that's what I think, and I just wanted to put that on the record. But I think you're doing a fantastic job, and we appreciate all the work you're doing.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I just wanted to say thank you to staff and to CFAC. It was great that you were able to come to us with a balanced budget. And just to respond to your comment, this was part of a labor negotiation that was prior to when you were on the council. So it really had to do with if we were able to meet target revenues, we would allow this raise, so which we were able to do. So I think we want to clarify that. We obviously know that moving forward, we're going to have a difficult time. And we could do that this year, but we may not be able to do the same kind of thing next year. So I'm looking forward to us really tackling this issue and coming up with some very creative solutions for next year's budget. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Any further discussion items?
Yes. Yeah, well, thank you for the lot of work that goes into this document, but also for adding the policy so quickly, the socially responsible investment policy so quickly. I, too, am concerned about employee wages, but I would caution us to think that we're going to balance the budget on the backs of not giving our employees any cost of living increases. And I think that's especially important given that our employees, some of them are the lowest paid in the county, the lowest paid in surrounding districts, and in cities that are facing equal budget difficulties. So my hope is that this council and our finance department really does focus on increasing revenues so that we don't freeze wages or look at ending COLA increases.
Thank you. Councilmember Davis, any discussion on this? Again, I'll add my thanks to staff for a tremendous number of opportunities to give input, but also, as always, excellent background information, lots of wonderful choices and opportunities, and you've educated us well with regard to the issues. This primarily, my discussion points are primarily for the community, and it's what I would call entering into whitewater times with regard to our budget. And I'll just summarize at a high level what we've seen over the last couple of months with our budget presentation, where the city currently is at. At present, with regard to our general fund, we're not meeting the goal of what would be called long-term structural budget balance. And that means if you look at this fiscal year, we balanced our budget primarily through defunding of internal service funds. That is, we used vehicle capital funds, technology and general capital funds, and some fire equipment funds to not fund this year. And use that instead to significantly contribute to balancing the budget. That's not sustainable as a not only a best practice, but not sustainable for the city to do, because that pot will deplete very rapidly. Our 10-year forecast, if you looked at that, and some might consider it to be very conservative, others not so, shows over a 10-year period cumulatively a $10 million deficit that we're facing as is with regard to the assumptions that have been made. That's just the general fund. That assumes 0% COLA increase in that 10-year plan. It also assumes a CalPERS discount rate, the investment return that CalPERS assumes that they're going to make at at about 7%. If that should drop and dip, which I think the majority of the state believes to be true, we're in a world of hurt even further with regard to our unfunded CalPERS liability. If the discount rate dropped from 7% to what some believe to be 6.15% currently, it would raise our liability by about $14 million overnight, just because CalPERS could not meet their investment portfolio assumptions. And that isn't in any of the numbers. That would be an added burden to what we already have. If you look at our CAFR, Consolidated Annual Finance Report, which is an award-winning report, by the way, and thank you for that, staff. If you look at it, it's got in the back of it a 10-year history, and it's got some really interesting information that I think is pertinent for the public to know. If you look back 10 years historically to the current budget as of the end of this year, our full-time equivalents in the city have decreased from 104 to 97.1, which means that the complexity of the work has grown, yet the number of full-time equivalents available to service all of that work has declined significantly. Our salaries and wages over a 10-year period have only increased 5.9% in 10 years. We're getting behind, and that could potentially in the future significantly impact recruitment and retention for the city. If you looked at our other expenses outside of salaries and wages, in a 10-year period, they've increased 0%. We spent the same 10 years ago on so-called other expenses that we did last year, which means that our total general fund expenses over a 10-year period have only risen from 11 to about $13.3 million. The point of that is staff, the city has done a tremendous job in holding down expenses. Now, that isn't to say that there isn't an opportunity for potential further cuts, but a $2.3 million increase in general fund expenses over 10 years is minimal, even if you look at just CPI increases. If you look at the revenue side, the story is even worse. Our general fund revenues have increased on the average over the last 10 years just $479,000 a year. Just $479,000 a year. That not only was not sustainable 10 years ago, it's not sustainable in the future. Our taxes, which include TOT, sales tax, and property tax, which is the primary source of the income or revenue the city receives, has only increased $327,000 average per year over the last 10 years. So the major sources of income, TOT, sales tax, and property tax combined, have risen very slightly on the average over the last 10 years. We have a significant revenue problem. We need to grow revenues incrementally to a degree that exceeds many times the average increase over the last 10 years. Our property tax revenues, if you kind of split that out, have in the last 10 years basically been flat. They've only increased a total of $550,000, not on average, the total over 10 years, only $550,000 from 10 years ago to today. We're not making it on property taxes. If you look at TOT, it's been basically flat. Now, we've had some increases, but for the last 4 years, not 10 years, for the last 4 years, it's been basically flat if you look at the big picture. Sales tax, the same. In fact, sales tax over the last 10 years has only increased from $2 to $3 million total on the average annual basis. The point of that is that we have a significant revenue problem in the city, and new sources of revenue are mandatory to be sustainable to maintain just day-to-day operations, not to do new things in the city, but just to maintain day-to-day operations. I haven't even talked about our unfunded capital improvement liabilities. And I don't mean that there's a liability that's sitting on the books for us that is there that has to be met. We do not have a capital budget, in essence. There are no dollars set aside for replacement of major structural citywide structures and infrastructure. And if you look at the cost annually to be able to begin to fund that rather than waiting for the time when it finally fails and you have to replace it, it's a huge hit to the city. The water and sewer fund are in great shape. Thank you, community, for the 218 votes that were approved in 2015 and the most recent one in 2018. That has shored up a fund that in the future will be well-funded and will be able to allow us to meet the capital needs for our water and sewer system. However, the Harbor Fund, which is our other enterprise fund, is severely underfunded. If you look at the Harbor Fund, and Jen did a 10-year plan, look ahead on the Harbor Fund this year. In essence, the Harbor Fund will have an accumulation of basically $165,000 in 10 years. We have millions of dollars of unfunded capital projects that need to be done in our harbor that can't be addressed because we don't have the money. An example of that is this past year we had a revetment failure. The seawall failed at one of our lease sites. That was about $1.5 million hit to the city. Fortunately, we were able to fund that, not directly with cash, but we funded it through concessions on one of the lessees that we had over a long period of time. Without that, I don't know how we would have paid for the failing seawall. That's just one example of a number of harbor projects that we're facing that we don't have funds for. My concern is that city, you know, this can impact general city services. If we don't do something significantly soon to dramatically increase our revenues, we will not have cash to fund general capital improvements and no cash to invest in future opportunities for revenue expansion. We must aggressively evaluate revenue opportunities to get significant increases quickly. And I know staff is very much aware of that. I'm mainly speaking to the public, trying to enlist public participation, not only in the budget process, but in the ongoing operations of the city as we look to both you as well as potentially new project development to fund our future. And so now is the time to come forward, to come out, to be involved as policy setters. That may sound very bleak. It is for me as a policy setter. But I'm optimistic that we have the staff in place and the council in place to be able to aggressively deal with this. But it will take dramatic change. And so, sorry for pontificating for such a long time on that. I feel that it is, if not the most important goal for now, maybe the most important goal for us in the next 10 years as a city in terms of future survival. With that, we do have a motion. And a second. Any further discussion? Not. Roll call vote.
Councilmember Davis?
Yes.
Councilmember McPherson?
Yes.
Councilmember Addis?
Yes.
Councilmember Heller?
Yes.
And Mayor Hedding?
Yes.
Motion carries 5-0.
Thank you. That takes us to item C-3, approval of visitor center services contract and lease agreement for city-owned property located at 695 Harbor Street. And I'll turn it over to our esteemed city manager, Ms. Collins.
Thank you, Mayor and Council. Real quickly, no PowerPoint here. This is two items in one. The first is the visitor center operations, and the other is the lease agreement with the chamber for the city-owned property at 695 Harbor Street, which is basically one and the same. As Council is aware, the chamber has served as the visitor center operators for several years, have done a great job. It's been $50,000 a year annualized on the fiscal year calendar, and they also have a $1 lease in return for helping to operate the overall facility, which includes radio station, other nonprofits, city tourism, and a number of other things that go on, and they're very important things that occur there. They help manage that facility alongside city public works staff. This year, there are some proposed slight modifications to the agreement. That is the Visitor Center's Operation Agreement. Those were prompted by discussions about the kind of underwhelming return of folks coming to the Visitor Center. We've seen a precipitous decline in number of folks coming to the Visitor Center, maybe due to location, probably due to some signage issues that the city owns. But it did prompt a good discussion about the future of the Visitor Center. A stakeholder group was formed that included council members, tourism folks, chamber folks, really good discussions about kind of long-term where the best location would be, the physical asset itself, but also kind of the services that are provided. And the stakeholder group kind of made the decision, I think it was a good one, that, you know, being that it was already March, looking forward to the summer months, which are where our town is on display to literally thousands of people on the weekends. We want to make sure we get it dialed in right for that and talk about the longer term issue, you know, next year. And the idea sprang up to really think about in connection to our tourism strategic plan that everybody, especially our businesses, are really ambassadors and extensions of our visitor center. We need to think that way. And that was conceived the idea of having a streets team that was an extension of the visitor center, would go on the peak weekends and sometimes during the week down to our visitor serving areas, downtown, waterfront, and other locations to leaflet the businesses about upcoming events, about their material from the visitor center so that they can be an extension of the visitor center, and also mingle with visitors and help answer questions. So that is a change from the existing agreement, which sort of puts the street team, if you will, at the Saturday farmers market. But they're stationary, and it's really kind of specific to that one event, and that's it. So this is a slight modification of that. We'll see how it goes and allow us to spend the remainder of this upcoming year to really discuss if, in fact, the visitor center should be moved and where and how that would look. There's a lot to be said about the existing center. We do have a parking lot. Maybe signage could help improve circulation to that, but I think that remains to be seen and be further analysis with the stakeholder group. So what we're looking for is approval of these agreements, and if any modifications need to be made, you know, would be in a form approved by the city attorney, but largely we have everything here and has been reviewed by chamber representatives. I'm happy to answer any questions that council has.
Thank you. Appreciate that. I'll open it up for council questions. Councilmember McPherson.
Go ahead.
Oh, Councilmember Addis, sorry.
I emailed my questions, and thank you to staff for answering those over the weekend via email.
Okay.
Okay. I really just have a couple. The first one is really has to do with what the street teams will do, and are you actually considering having them mostly work with businesses so that the businesses are the ones that would be educating? So there might be some training of businesses on how to do that and whatnot, or are you?
I think that's a good question. I mean, primarily it's to focus on the businesses, make sure they're up to speed about what's coming. So that, you know, an extension of our efforts to improve communication broadly, this helps inform those businesses that are in tourist-serving areas. And the idea is that also they sort of be identified as ambassadors, the street team, and they can make connections with visitors themselves. And this, again, is kind of to be viewed as a pilot. I think Erica, the chamber CEO, is kind of formulating it as we speak. We wanted to see if this was a concept that council approved and something they could turn around pretty quickly. But if Erica wants to expand on that, or is that answered? Yeah.
Sure. Come forward,
sure,
please.
Sure.
Welcome, Erica.
Hi. Thank you. Yeah, as Scott said, it is not fully formed. It is definitely a concept. The idea is that we would have people on the street kind of as the glue. You know, we hear from businesses quite a lot saying, if I had known that that street was going to be closed down, you know, or why is that street closed down, or what's happening? You know, they're just kind of, as we would expect as a former business owner, you're running your business. You're within your four walls. You're not always aware of what's happening. But we don't necessarily need, nor is it feasible that somebody who's out on the street going business to business in one district would, you know, that would take 4 hours. We don't want it to take 4 hours. So I think the vision is early. Maybe they'd be wearing something that's, you know, visitor services or, you know, something that's identifiable, and maybe they'll go hang out where the otters are for an hour and just engage. Because what we talked about in some of our outreach was that the metric of success currently is, you know, physical traffic through the center. But what if we started to look at it as visitor engagement and start to talk to people as they're out there and encourage them to just go down the way and take a right and go look at that, you know? So we're just not doing that right now. We're relying on our businesses to do that for us.
So you would plan on evaluating this strategy after a year? So
yeah.
You'd basically try it during this coming summer and prepare some kind of a analysis of whether it worked or needed to be changed. And you are still, you're not giving up on the idea of a brick and mortar visitor center.
No, this whole concept is a home base, which is at 695 Harbor Street.
Okay,
which
but
will
we
be open, you know, 7 days a week, 362 days a year.
But we are going to be working on the issue of where to relocate.
Yes.
During the coming year.
Yeah, I mean, there was no concrete findings, and I think there's some opportunity to improve signage. But the group kind of pivoted to, okay, what can we do knowing summer is coming up in a few months?
I think funding, too.
Right.
You know,
and
I mean,
funding.
This has stayed at $50,000. You know, it costs money to move and relocate. So I think that was a big concern also.
Right. And you are working with the Historical Society as a possible joint.
Sure. Well, we've been engaged, by the Historical Society and leave that
museum
open.
Museum and visitor center.
Yes, great. We're co-located.
Great. Just wanted to confirm that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, I was going to come up and make public comment, but I'll do it now since we're talking about staff, just to say that, you know, our staff does act as a concierge for the city, but they're also acting as receptionists for that whole building. And so Ed, Jan, Sharon, and Janine, I've been running that visitor center for 3.5 years now. Never have we had an issue with schedule. You know, never has somebody just not called or not shown up. These are kind, responsible, awesome human beings. Many of them have been doing this for a long time. So I just want to publicly say they're awesome employees. So best I've had. Thanks.
Great. Other questions? Red? And so I had a couple questions. It seems like one of the issues, and you talked about signage, are we talking about, I guess my question is, are we talking about signage on the visitor center itself to improve signage?
It may be that, but it's the leading the traffic to the actual visitor center.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of that's going to go through the wayfinding process, and you can understand if we're talking about potentially moving the visitor center in the future, that maybe puts some limitations on that. But there are other signage opportunities that exist that maybe haven't been taken advantage of fully to help drive traffic to the physical location.
Great. Okay, and then the other question I had to do with the measurement. Now your current measure is visitors to the visitor center. How will you incorporate the concierge service, more or less, as I describe it, and how is that going to be measured in terms of, I mean, I get the visitor center visits, but is it interactions or questions that people ask, or what's the measure?
Yeah, I think it's...
That we'll track, or you'll track.
It sounds like it's that, as Erica mentioned, it's engagement, so I'm sure we can track the number of contacts. That's a host program in Santa Cruz that I was a part of a long time ago. That's how they sort of track the number of interactions, and then as they got better at it, you know, distill that down to, okay, well, did you recommend a restaurant, or was it the bathroom you were looking for? Just kind of understanding the type of information that people are seeking. But I think because this is the first go at it, it may be more simple and number of engagements.
Kind of looking at it as a log. You know, when somebody's coming in for their visitor liaison shift, they're going to be taking their materials, maps, things like that, and then they're going to be saying, okay, I'm going to go to this area for these next few hours. And when they come back, this is where I was, this is what I saw. You know, it's just a little blotter.
Okay, so my last question is, it seems like this is an ongoing process for improvement. Can you describe for me what the mechanism is going to be in this next year to do the next level of evaluation and what the timelines are for achieving that and who's responsible?
I don't have a clear-cut answer to that. I think Eric identified one of the key issues is the cost. Because we have the arrangement that we have, this is a very affordable option. So you got to compare that against, you know, if the city had to pay rent for a building or to host the visitor center, what that would do to the economics and what that would do for the services to be able to provide. And are there available sites that are in better locations? That's also a factor. And do we want to put something like this in a place where a for-profit business could occupy? So those are the kind of considerations we need to go through. I think re-engaging the stakeholder group probably after we get through the summer would be a good idea because a lot of those folks are working hard. This is the peak time for them, so we don't want to necessarily bother them with this at this point. But maybe after the summer we can engage and see how the street team's approach went and then carry the discussion forward.
Okay, great. Thank you. With that, I'll open it up for public comment. Any members of the public wishing to come forward regarding item number C3, please do so now. Surveying the audience, heads looking down. See nobody come forward. I'll close public comment, bring it back to council. I'll entertain a motion.
Okay. I will move that the City Council approve the agreements with the Morro Bay Chamber of Commerce for visitor center services and the renewal of a property lease at 695 Harbor Street.
I'll second.
So a motion by Councilmember McPherson for the staff recommendation, seconded by Councilmember Addis. Any further comments or discussion?
I have a quick comment.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I commend this approach of the street teams. I think council had a discussion maybe last time we met about increasing communication and how effective it was for some of the campaigners when they went out door knocking and how we wished that we could get out there and have that person-to-person interaction instead of always expecting people to come to us. And so I really do want to commend the chamber for having that kind of thinking and being willing to look at things from a different point of view and getting out and meeting people where they're at. I think I'm excited to see what this turns out like, and I appreciate those efforts.
Good, and I will support the motion. I just wanted to comment that I think it's one thing to try to capture visitors when they're here to give them information. It's another thing to capture visitors on Highway 1 driving by the city that may wonder, is there a place to stop? And I think signage helps capture those folks when they see that big Caltrans prepared or whoever prepares that tourist information sign, and there's good signage to the visitor center. It's very helpful in capturing those that don't go immediately to social media and Google something and look it up online, which maybe a lot of us do. But I would like to see that, and then I think it'd be helpful to further define the process for your engagement for next year and maybe give us an update in the future. But those are my comments. With that, roll call vote.
Councilmember McPherson.
Yes.
Councilmember Addis.
Yes.
Councilmember Davis.
Yes.
Councilmember Heller.
Yes.
And Mayor Hedding.
Yes.
Motion carries 5-0.
Thank you. That closes item C3. Moving on to item C4. This is the proposed framework for economic development of facilitation support services provided to the city by the Chamber of Commerce. And with that, I will turn this over to Mr. Collins again. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor. I do have a PowerPoint this time.
Hey.
So this item is, as you mentioned, it's the Economic Development Partnership proposal with the Chamber for an economic development point person or facilitator. I believe you have copies. Hopefully you have copies of this PowerPoint, so I can't read it. Basically, the city, most importantly, the city adopted a strategic economic development strategic roadmap in 2017. A really robust outreach effort to stakeholders across the board to get input about how the city can develop a roadmap to move out of the wake of the closure of the Morro Bay power plant, unlike the Diablo power plant that has a Senate Bill 1090 attached to it, which will provide school districts and the cities and the counties millions of dollars to help deal with the transition away from that economic generator. We had none of that. So the city took it upon itself with the community to develop a roadmap. One of the key findings out of that was that the city identify and appoint a point person for economic development activity to really help make this roadmap a reality. At the time, the preferred position for the point person was the relatively new position of the deputy city manager. However, shortly into the fiscal year 17-18 budget, mid-year, the decision was made to cut that position after the position had been vacated. That was a budget-saving measure. We've learned to do what we were currently doing with less, but one of the areas that has sort of fallen off has been the economic development piece. And just we've taken various tacks to address not having a point person, beginning with creating sort of a economic development team approach, if you will, which included the tourism manager, the harbor director, planning director, myself, and the chamber CEO. And, I think it was good. We had good, robust discussions, but not really an opportunity to kind of, if there was an opportunity, there arisen how to really effectively address that. The city did enter into a limited partnership with the chamber for this current fiscal year called the 4MB program. The four represents the four business corridors in town, the downtown waterfront, North Main, and Quintana. A lot of outreach to the business community through walks, forums, trainings that have been really helpful and effective for business support and development. We've got great input from the various four districts on wayfinding, as well as the specific input on the downtown tree lighting program that has gone pretty well. And we're nearing completion of the design for the wayfinding, so those folks were very instrumental in making sure we had something that was effective for them. But in that new sort of limited partnership, the experience really underscored the need for having a point person. We heard loud and clear through business walks where some issues could have been addressed on the permitting side, or where, you know, there was a missed opportunity for a business to expand somewhere else in town, or hearing through our partners at the EVC or the Hourglass Project, hey, you know, there's a firm that's interested in moving into Morro Bay, you know, you should follow up. And it's like, okay, wait, I really want to follow up, and I'm also managing the wharf project. I'm also managing this, that, and the other. And, you know, it's sort of in the list of priorities, it's a hard thing to get to as a city manager and a planning director who's running general plan updates. So I think our experience has shown that, you know, the city was on the right place or in the right direction considering a point person 2 years ago. I think we've kind of come around to that realization ourselves and really just trying to figure out how to finance that effectively. Adding another position in the environment we're in right now doesn't make a lot of sense. A fully freighted deputy city manager or equivalent would be $150,000 to $200,000. I don't think there's any appetite for adding that at this time. But could we gain a lot of the benefits that could come from that position in another method? And that's where we've sort of come up with this idea for a partnership with the chamber, building upon the 4MB effort. In terms of supporting businesses, that was a real win for the 4MB programs. Could continue that effort, engage with the city manager of Paso Robles. They have a robust agreement with the chamber to conduct all their economic development activities for the most part. And talking with the chamber CEO and her talking to her board, I'm talking to city council members individually and just my own assessment. And we believe these three key areas of support from the chamber would be very effective. The business support, which is already kind of ongoing with the 4MB effort, is really to hone in on the business's needs, the existing businesses. We are, by and large, a small business community, and we need to own that and help ensure that they're effective. And if they want to expand, they want to achieve more, you know, goals, how do we help them as best we can in a cost-effective manner? The next is a New Day in Morro Bay marketing effort. It's not strictly just PR, but it's really about, you know, we want to put ourselves out there. We do have a lot of catalyst sites, obviously, and opportunity sites, and we've missed some opportunities in the past. We don't want to let that happen again. How do we help let folks know we're open for business? That, you know, it's not to say we need to change and become Pismo Beach. It's not at all what we mean, but there are opportunities that we need to take advantage of and say that we are a business-friendly community. We will not lose our character in that process, but we need to take advantage of that to ensure that our community is on a viable path moving into the future. And then the last is the permit processing support and review. It's two parts of that. The one is to assist businesses in a kind of a pre-planning permit scenario where they can kind of come in and get help, some facilitation to ensure they're moving in the right place before they submit anything to the city, as well as reviewing the overall permit process for development. You know, we've heard some issues out in the community. I think some of that could be education, and some of that could be our processes and a capacity. So, you know, using this year to sort of unpack all those issues. Currently, the city has about $62,000 budgeted for fiscal year 1920 to support such an effort. Thanks to the Herculean lift by our finance director, help find those pots of monies and put it together to give this a shot for this year, and again to build off the 4MB effort. What we're proposing, it's in the staff report, is a communications and structure where the city manager and the chamber CEO would meet pretty regularly to have consistent communication to understand the lay of the land, what's going on, what are opportunities, how can I assist, how can she assist, and work well together. Creation of an oversight committee that could contain chamber staff, board members, council members, city staff, that would take a bit of a deeper dive on a more, I guess, quarterly basis or monthly basis, depending, really probably in the initial phases, meeting more regularly, and as we get our groove, you know, maybe it's less frequent, but be able to look at data and see how we're doing. The chamber and the city would maintain their independence. This is a partnership, but chamber employees are participating in this, will maintain their employeeship with chamber. They'll not be reporting to me. They will not be reporting to my staff. They will not be employed by the city, so just want to make sure that's clear. And then the agreement has, you know, have some performance data. I think initially the focus will be on output measures. The New Day in Morro Bay is one that comes to mind. This will take time to kind of shift perspectives about Morro Bay. And if we see new business starts, they may take a couple years. You know, these things don't move quickly, but we want to make sure we're putting ourselves in the best possible place. That includes making connections, and then it's a council member, not necessarily a chamber CEO or the city manager, who's actually making those connections. We're just establishing the link and then handing it off to the appropriate person to help take it to the next level. So, you know, this is a very flexible model, I should say. But as far as measurements, we're looking at contacts that are made, meetings that are held, presentations hosted, permits stamped complete, training attendance, completion of marketing materials. We're talking about a new economic development website, so helping launch that and keep it fresh. So we're thinking about outcome measures in year two or three potentially. Now, understanding this is a one-year agreement because the funding is only guaranteed for this year, but I think, you know, it's not like this need is going to diminish over time. It's only going to become more important. So we try to see this as more than a one-year, but there is limitations because our budget is what it is. So, again, looking sort of for a flexible model, and as we grow, looking to transition to outcome measurements. So our recommendation is to direct staff to work with the chamber staff to develop an agreement in conjunction with the city attorney along the terms that have been discussed in the staff report and tonight, and anything that council would direct or want to modify, and then bring that back for council and chamber board consideration on the June 25th meetings, respective chamber board and city council meetings. Concludes my presentation. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Scott. Appreciate that. And this is not an action item. This is an input item, and the action item will be coming back to us. So I'll open it up for council questions. Red?
preparing this, and I've been impressed with the letters of support I received from the Chamber Board, which indicates to me full commitment of the Chamber of Commerce to support Erica to help us with this key action. The Oversight Committee, can you elaborate a little bit on your vision of how that Oversight Committee would work with Chamber staff and board, council and city staff participation?
Yeah, I would see, maybe one representative from each of those entities, so maybe four or five people, maybe a little bit more, but not much more. And it's really kind of looking at any trends that are coming forward, any particular issues that have arisen that maybe are a bit more sensitive in nature. You know, it's just kind of discussing those and then looking at the data that's available. That's what's... We heard from PASO work really well, and Tom Frucci is an exceptional city manager, and they have a really good relationship. So, you know, what they had to say made a lot of sense, and that's sort of where that idea came from. Right. Currently, with the 4MB model, it's a presentation to city council is the reporting mechanism. And I think this may be a little more effective as far as problem solving and addressing trends. Not to say that there wouldn't be a presentation to council on semi-annual or annual basis, but this allows there to be a more targeted discussion.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Other comments, or questions, I should say.
I have some. I also had that question. Would you see that board developing strategies also?
Excellent question. I don't know, Erica. Phone a friend.
Yeah. Help.
I think the key, Erica, from the chamber, the key for me is that that sensitive component, you know, and kind of talking story and really being able to get into details. Because there is sensitive information that we are already kind of uncovering in some of our outreach to businesses who are looking to invest here, builders who are looking to build here. You know, there are things that are coming up. So, I would imagine, I don't know, strategy, but to do what with, you know, I think the key for me is this partnership and advocacy piece, because we can investigate, we can consult, we can talk, we being the chamber, but we aren't the ones who can make the changes. You know, the change actually comes through the partnership with the city. So if we're talking about strategy, that's good, but how do we implement that strategy? That could be, you know, change in policy or change in process that the chamber isn't, we're not the correct body to do that.
Okay. And can you also, maybe you want to just stay, Erica. We talk about a point person, so can you tell me who you envision to be that point person so that we have some understanding, and also how that $62,000 would be spent?
Sure. I think there will be hard costs and soft costs. Some of what we're showing are like a relocation guide, a video spot, convening people together in a way that makes them want to come to the table. Sometimes requires cookies and donuts. You know, it's a little hard cost. The soft cost really is in the time spent to follow up with outreach, to make initial contact, all of that. So it's labor. You know, it really is a lot of soft cost is in the people power it'll take to get this scope of services done. I don't think it's any secret that I really enjoy this kind of work. My board knows that I really enjoy this kind of work, so the point person will be me. The facilitation services will be provided by me. But we're calling it the chamber CEO. My famous for saying, I could get hit by a bus, you know, so you got to keep that title. It's not, this isn't a personality driven thing. This really should be a process task match to people who are occupying those roles. So, yeah.
So would you envision using some of that money then to backfill some of the things that you would normally be doing if you're going to take this on as a
major? Yeah, so I think it'll be in order to administer the contract, we'll take labor. So there will be a contract administration fee for getting this scope of services done. And, okay. Yeah, and we'll make sure that that's done responsibly and reported out.
And this would be in the agreement that we're going to see a more detailed plan as well as how the money will be spent, so a budget for it or something so that we have some understanding of...
Sure. Yeah, I mean, we can break it out. Yeah, but I mean, it is not... This isn't something that other cities and other chambers don't do. You know, we're not reinventing some new system. And you know that I, you know, have been educated in the Western Association Chamber Executives. You know, there are plenty of other chambers that do this, and it is it's a contract administration fee.
I see.
And as long as we are delivering on what the scope of services that are outlined in that contract, what we're judged on.
Okay, so it's the scope of services that we need to focus on.
Yeah.
Okay, that's very helpful. Okay. And would you envision collaborating with others in the region? Are you taking a more regional?
Yeah, absolutely. We just had breakfast with Melissa James and Andrew Hackelman this morning. You know, it's a... Not only are we part of the, you know, Hourglass contact and EVC contact, but I'm meeting monthly with our chamber CEOs all the way from Paso down to Lompoc and Buellton. You know, we're very connected, and we're all talking about what's happening in the region with investment, business. You know, that's what we care about. What chamber we care about business.
Okay.
And community, I shouldn't say.
Yeah, and would you be including? You mentioned something about reporting, maybe on a semi-annual or annual basis. You report to us now on a quarterly basis. Mm-hmm. Is that unreasonable to?
I don't think so at all. I mean, I'm already coming for a visitor center reporting. We can include.
Just so we have an update, some sense of what's going on and what's happening.
Activities, high level sort of
stats
on. Yeah, I think there was some of that that was laid out in Scott's presentation.
Okay. And in terms of outcome measures, if you could at least propose some, because even if some of it is anecdotal during this first year, if you actually get businesses to locate here, I mean, I would hope you would tell us about that.
Oh, yeah.
And also to think about what you might long-term be looking at as some of those outcome measures. So.
Yeah. I think as you were talking earlier, you know, especially with what you said, Mayor Heading, with the budget, you know, the city needs to build revenue, and from this perspective, my perspective, the city will build its revenue by building its business community and enabling their success. So that really is what the effort behind this is all about, without transforming our community to be something that's unrecognizable. That's not what we're looking to do.
Thank you.
Sure.
Any other questions? Dawn?
Well, I emailed a lot over the weekend, but some were answered. But the primary one is the one that Councilmember McPherson asked about outcome measures, so I won't repeat that.
Good, thank you. My question was the Oversight Committee. Are we creating another advisory body that is going to have to meet all the, in my terms, onerous requirements of creating a policy and reporting as an advisory body to council, and then burdening staff with a lot of report requirements for public comments and so forth and so on? Or do you see a different format for that?
I don't necessarily see it as a Brown Act, but a Brown Act committee. But I let the city attorney weigh in on that to make sure I'm not speaking out of turn.
It would depend upon the type of organization that's created. Essentially, if it becomes a Brown Act body, like city manager is referring to, then it's going to need to comply with having agendas and notices and public comment and whatnot. If it is not a Brown Act body, then it wouldn't have to comply with all those requirements. And it becomes a Brown Act body if essentially the city is going to be city council delegates certain authority or advisory functions on a permanent basis to the committee. But we can look into those details and get back to you all on which way we would go.
Okay, and. Are we, with regard to this ombudsman position, not only looking at responding to potential new business opportunities, but will this also assist existing businesses with business? I see. I don't know if the audience can see you, so we need a response.
Yes,
thanks.
Absolutely. I think that, and I don't have the statistic straight off my head, but something like 80%+ of new jobs in any economy come from existing businesses. So, yes, we are absolutely working with our existing businesses. I was just contacted by the Trib for a list of new businesses that had just come into Morro Bay, and I, you know, submitted, I think it was about 11 businesses. But many of them were, you know, relocations from a smaller space to a bigger space or something that was going to work better for their business type. So, you know, that is expansion, and we want to keep that going.
Great. Thank you. Those are all the questions I have. With that, I'll open it up for public comment. And this is item C4 on the agenda. I do have one speaker slip. Steve Peck, come on up, sir. Good to see you this evening. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, members of the council, staff. My name is Stephen Peck. I'm a director with the Chamber of Commerce, and I'm one of the co-chairs, along with Ken McMillan, of the Governmental Affairs Committee. I've been doing this kind of work for probably 40 years now, and I can tell you that communities that are successful at economic development do what Scott just described. They get the business, the community, and the decision makers aligned to propose business expansions, new business locations. So this is really essential to meeting your budget shortfall. I think you have a wonderful opportunity now to sort of make these things work. As good as your staff may be, they can't ask some of the questions we can ask sort of in private with a developer who may be having difficulty or may be looking here and has been scared off by somebody else who had a bad experience. That's where we come in. And then sharing those experiences tactfully and confidentially so that if there are problems, they can be solved. So I think what we bring to the table, what the staff brings to the table, are two complementary things, and I would encourage you to go forward with this recommendation by staff.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it. Public comment is open on item C4 on our agenda. Nick, welcome. Good to see you out this evening.
Hello, my name is Nick Mendoza. I have a restaurant in North Morro Bay, and I just want to speak to this economic development program. Part of the program involves breaking the city into four districts: North Morro Bay, downtown, Quintana, and the Embarcadero. So being in North Morro Bay, it's been really encouraging to having these quarterly meetings with different businesses from North Morro Bay, because sometimes North Morro Bay is kind of the orphan of Morro Bay, kind of gets ignored sometimes. And so to have people come from the chamber and other businesses from the area to talk about, right now, talking about signage and how we can get people to come to North Morro Bay when they're in Morro Bay. You know, we have that great Morro Strand Beach that's incredible, and I don't think a lot of people know about that. So how can we let people know when they're down the Embarcadero or downtown, when they do their thing there, they can come to North Morro Bay and enjoy what we have as well. We have a lot of restaurants, a lot of Mexican restaurants, and and so besides the beach and just it's Del Mar Park, we have a lot of things to let our visitors know and our locals also. And we get a lot of people from the valley that come annually. So I just want to let you know that I think the program, even though it's just starting and we're kind of finding our way, I think it's really encouraged how we've come so far in just this year. So I would encourage you to continue with this economic development program. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. Appreciate that. Public comment is still open on item C4. Any members of the public wishing to come forward? Do so now. Scanning the audience. Seeing none, I'll close public comment, bring it back to council. And maybe I'll start off this time and first of all thank not only our staff who've been involved with that, primarily Mr. Collins, not only for the report but for your work on this, but also want to thank the council for making this a priority during our goal setting session, which we unanimously agreed upon. And thanks to the Chamber Board for their significant support of this initiative and the recognition that it will contribute significantly to new revenue opportunities in the city. My sense is that we want to be cautious with regard to the development of a formal committee that is a Brown Act committee. I think it encumbers staff. I'm not trying to shut out public comment or anything else. I think that this kind of I won't even call it an oversight committee, but more of a communications committee and a dialogue committee or something of the sort, but limit its purposes so that it doesn't become so onerous and stressful for both staffs to have to worry about the requirements of that. That's my recommendation or my concern. The other would be, I think I've identified some critical success factors. One is being nimble and reacting quickly. And I know we've talked in ex parte communication. I met with Erica and chatted in detail about this. And, of course, have talked to our city manager about this. But also being informed with the right information to bring to a potential new business entity that's being considered would be very important in getting them to the right place. I think wayfinding of people to right departments is a critical success factor for this to work. Consistent follow-up, I've identified, at least in my mind, as something that is a critical success factor once you've made a contact, following up on that contact routinely. And then connecting the right people. Personally, I don't see this just as an Erica venture, but I think Erica, as the point person, goes out and says, I need to connect this person with person X, either on the council or in the city or another business person that could be helpful, or the planning department, or you name it. And having that knowledge base of where to connect people would be an absolute requirement for success for this. And so I'm excited to see this happen. Personally, I don't think we've invested enough money in economic development, but with this year's budget, we're constrained. Hopefully, in the future, that will open up, and I look forward to the framework that you'll be bringing to us for formal approval as that comes back to council. So thank you, and I'll open it up to other comments.
Okay, well, I'll go next since you looked at me.
I'm looking everywhere.
I know. I really support this idea very enthusiastically. When it was first mentioned at our goals meeting about an ombudsman, and I was really concerned about creating another position or having to go out and search for a contract employee, and I didn't even see it getting off the ground at that point. So knowing that we have somebody who has proven that they can be effective and will be effective and can just take the ball and run with it, I am so grateful that the Chamber is willing to take on this role. I also agree with the Mayor about the Oversight Committee. I had concerns about that also. I wasn't clear on what their function was going to be and how it was going to work, and so maybe you could think a little bit more about that before you bring the agreement to us at our next meeting. But anyway, I'm excited, and I hope you will use the council. I think all of us would be more than happy to meet with people and be your, the person that you bring in to try to do a little persuasion. So, yeah, those are my comments.
Thank you. Councilmember Heller. Thank you.
Yeah, I think it's extremely well-conceived concept, and I'm just very excited about it. And your collaboration with other cities and other chambers is very exciting, and I have very high hopes for this. And thank you.
Good. Comments to my left. Councilmember Davis.
I have been privileged to participate with Erica and Scott on the 4MB business walks, as well as attending the quarterly meetings. They're not actually quarterly. They're every 4 months, because there are four business sections in Morro Bay. And in fact, the Quintana group is meeting tomorrow at 8:30 at Forever Stoked. And certainly everyone on Quintana who has a business is invited to attend, as well as anyone who is interested in developing economic opportunities. And I am very impressed with Erica's connection with the business community and the trust that the Chamber has built up under her leadership, as reflected by the stellar members of the Chamber's Board of Directors. The The only thing I would not want to see is that the oversight committee be a Brown Act. I think that would be too cumbersome. It would be too much of a burden on staff. As the mayor said, we need to be nimble and be informed, and an oversight committee is the way for this to proceed. So those are my thoughts about moving forward with this.
Thank you. Councilmember Addis.
I appreciate the chamber, and I really appreciate the Government Affairs Committee. I think it's critical for the chamber and council and the city to be in tight communication, but it just shows your dedication to take the time to write to us or to come out to a meeting. And thank you for the love for North Morro Bay. I live up there, and it's always been a dream of mine that North Morro Bay could develop just a little bit more. And so I share your enthusiasm for getting a little bit more going up there. I think there's a lot of uniqueness to the north side of Morro Bay. And I would agree with my colleagues in terms of an oversight committee and the comments about not wanting a Brown Act committee and wanting this to be something that can move quickly. And for us to be continuing to think about what are the outcome measures and how do we start to articulate those, knowing that in this first amount of time there's not going to be outcomes per se, but that as we continue the program, that we'll want to see something from it that is outcome, not just efforts.
Great comments all around, and hopefully you have good direction, and we'll look forward to the formal agreement coming back at a future meeting soon. With that ends our meeting for this evening, except for item D, future agenda items. Looking to my left.
Yes, so I started the meeting talking about on-land fracking and a possible future agenda item to look at a resolution around on-land fracking. We had received a number of emails from folks that wanted the City of Morro Bay to weigh in on the BLM open comment period around fracking in San Luis Obispo County. And that comment period closed on June 10th. And I approached the mayor about it and learned through the mayor that we don't have a resolution that is against on-land fracking. And so we weren't able to submit, or the city wasn't able to submit a letter. The mayor wasn't able to submit a letter on behalf of the city. So I submitted my own comments. The mayor submitted his own comments. But we couldn't do anything without that resolution. So I think the ask is that council consider this as a future agenda item.
Yes, I submitted comments as well on the BLM website. And so I support this.
I would support it.
Yeah, obviously I do. I submitted comments. So.
Okay.
We had enough anyway. Okay, so that's good. Other?
I have.
Oh, here they go. No.
No, this is actually one that is already going to be on our agenda, and it is the one that has to do with the advisory board changes to the handbook and changes to the advisory boards. I just want to make sure that we can expand what we said we were going to look at and look more broadly. At some of the roles and clarifying language that isn't clear, so that we can, since we're going to look at it, we can do it in a more holistic way. So that's my request.
Chris, would that require a new agenda item, or would that fall under the purview of the previous mandate? Do you recall?
It sounds to me like the councilwoman is asking to expand the original direction, so I would think that we would want to have consensus that would be added if we wanted to move forward that way.
Added, or do we need to agendize it, come back, discuss it, or it, just move forward?
It can be added as a new agenda item. You're saying, is this direction going to be added to the direction? The direction to staff can be provided tonight when they come back, because that would be the new agenda item. The new agenda item would be come back with this added to the other agenda item.
Okay. Got it. So I would support that too.
I'm confused.
We talked about it in the
Is this the same thing we've talked about?
It is.
Regarding looking at all the committees and
right.
What should be Brown Act bodies and which ones should not be. And So is that the same?
And yes, exactly.
Okay.
And clarifying the language in the handbook, which is what started this, and Red has already agendized that for a future agenda item. I just wanted to expand it to make it a more holistic look at the responsibilities and clarification of language. And
yes, so if a majority of the council wants to do that, then it would be a future agenda item, and it would just be part of what's already coming back.
Okay, that's good.
So I support it.
I support it.
So we've got, yeah, no. Okay, good. Jeff, did you have one?
I have one more.
Yes, sir.
It's kind of old news, but I feel kind of obligated to put this on the future agenda. Mm-hmm. In 2015, we had a Prop 218 approved by the voters for various rate increases. The last one, I think, will go into effect on July 1st of this year. But from what I've heard, this increase will generate approximately $6 million a year, $3 million to the water and $3 million to the sewer facility. One of the reasons for this increase was replacing leaking sewer lines, to my knowledge, none of which have been replaced. So I would like something, agendize this so that we can get a report back from the city staff about what the schedule is to get this work done or at least started, and also a report on what has been done with that money that has been generated over the last almost 4 years now based on that 218 increase. So
I would, thank you. I would ask staff for possibly just a clarification, does not the One Water Plan and the current CIP project list approved for this budget do exactly that, if I'm correct? Or I'm just trying to see if, or is it more broad than that?
Well, I don't know if it's more broad or not. I just know there are a lot of people in the community that ask that question, and it seems like a fairly simple answer. I don't want to make it into some kind of, I don't want to have to look at the One Water study to figure it out. I would just like staff to say, look, this is, we've generated these funds over the last 3.5 years. This is what we use the funds for. We will be putting in replacing collection lines starting on this date, or some kind of a tentative schedule so that we know that something is happening. Every time this comes up, it seems to kind of fall into a black hole. So,
Rob, I'll just look to you. Is that the CIP program? My sense is we don't need to go look at the One Water Plan, but this year's
it's
budget
in the current
includes
budget,
CIP.
For the first 5 years, starting the first 5 years worth of sewer and water CIPs and completing those within 5 years. So we have the two major collection system improvement projects and the one major water system project, which are composed of smaller projects listed in the One Water Plan. So we lumped them together because it didn't make sense to do engineering on a few hundred feet of pipe, go build that, go do engineering on another few hundred feet of pipe. So we lumped those logical projects together.
Okay.
And those are in the approved budget.
Comment?
I think we provided a similar report, but this was last year, just trying to recollect on, maybe it was a WRF update, either a WRF CAC or council, on the WRF finances, that it sort of tried to address the question that Mr. Councilmember Heller was asking about. It's the accumulation fund is where the mm-hmm. those revenues have been
right.
pushed into, and it sort of looked at what we had projected as revenues and then where they actually were, and there was a bit of a difference because of the drought. And that actually pushed down water usage, would also push down our revenues. But we showed where that had been accumulated, and that's largely being used for the cash on hand for the WRF project. But we could probably regenerate that report just to update it and refresh it, and maybe just present it as information reports to council if there isn't support for an agenda item, because this information exists. It's just kind of putting it in a package.
I would really appreciate just a summary level report like that you present. I don't know that we need to make a huge deal out of it.
I'm thinking I've seen this report and I know what's in the capital improvement. I mean, I think this information has already been provided. So my suggestion would be to just send an email to Councilmember Heller with that information.
Like with the links.
Yeah, with the links to.
I mean, I don't know about using staff time to
rewrite
a report.
We have it already, so it's
right.
It's not a huge deal, and it's
right.
I mean, these kind of requests are made by council members all the time. It's not. Sure. I don't think we need a future agenda item to transmit the information. So I.
Okay,
if that
just,
helps.
Just
you,
send me some sweet links, will you? Sweet
well,
links.
Send it to us all. It would be important to all
because all really good information.
Good.
Okay.
And thank you for that because I do think it's important to have an audit trail in writing. For the community, even though we may have seen it, and getting it together in one package in one place.
And,
so I appreciate that.
Can I promise immediate delivery? Because
we're
still working on completing the budget, so we don't want to, you know.
Tomorrow's fine. Yeah. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
Exactly.
No worries. You had some time. Okay. Thank you. Any other? Seeing none, I will adjourn the meeting. The next regular meeting will be held at Morro Bay City Council. Will be held on Tuesday, June 25th, 2019 at 5:30 p.m. at the Veterans Memorial Hall, located at 209 Surf Street, Morro Bay, California. Have a pleasant evening. See you then.